our last meeting. So we thought that let's use the slot next week, because Parliament is only closing on the 10th of December. But that as it may, without really wasting any time, we are wishing everybody very well, and we hope that we are going to have a good rest amidst the Omicron variant that is there. Hopefully every one of us is vaccinated. And if it hits us, it must not at least hit us so hard. Llewellyn, can we get the roll call?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, members, Minister and officials from the department. Chair, our roll call to yourself, Mbingo Gigaba, Chairperson. I have Honourable Aduans. I have Honourable Siwela, Honourable Letsie, Honourable Morwa Chetla. I have Honourable Van der Walt, Honourable Dr. Tembekwayo, Honourable Lobo. I've got three apologies. That's for Honourable Yabo, Honourable Mashabela, and Honourable Sukers. And then from the department, I have received correspondence from the Office of the Deputy Minister. She is hosting the Cuban Deputy Minister this morning, and she won't be able to join us. Thank you, Chairperson. That's on my side.
Okay, thank you very much. Members, on our agenda, we are having only one item for today, which is the, we are being briefed on the state of school readiness for next year by the department. And then after that, we are going to consider and adopt the minutes of the last meeting. Can I have the agenda being adopted?
Sir?
Honorable Letsie and Aduans.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning to yourself, Chair, and honorable members. Good morning, Minister, the DG and the team from the department and our staff. From Parliament, my name is Teboho Letsie. I move for the adoption of the agenda as presented. Thanks.
Thanks, Debza. Honorable Aduans?
Thanks, Chair. I second the adoption. Thank you.
Thank you so much. The meeting then is adopted without wasting any time. Minister, let's hear your voice, young. Yeah, it's been quite some time.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chair, to have missed quite a number of meetings. It was not out of disrespect. But thanks again for the opportunity, Chair, to present to the team our school readiness report. It's normally the time of the year where we also work very close with provinces to check where the problems are and if provinces are ready and if there's anything we can do. But I think all the information, Chair, will come from the report. But thank you very much for, again, giving us an opportunity to address the Portfolio Committee on Basic Education.
Recording in progress.
And as usual, we'll await your guidance and counsel. But yeah, we are moving to 2022 with, again, anxieties of the new virus. And 2021 has not been very easy because I think we're all aware of what the virus has been disrupting the system. And we were hoping that by 2022, we could find some normality, but it's not quite clear. So we'll play it by ear and hear what comes. But Chair, let me not take too much of your time. The DG or whoever he's delegated will present the report and we'll await your comments after the full presentation of the report. Thank you very much, Chair. DM is hosting, as the apology came, she is on her way to the Eastern Cape. She's hosting the Deputy Minister of Cuba. We had a whole day with her yesterday. It was a great activity, but she'll be moving with her to the Eastern Cape. From there, they moved to the Free State and back to Gauteng. But thank you very much, Chair, and thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Minister. DG?
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, Honourable Minister. The presentation is going to be done by Mrs. Geyer. We cover a host of areas there, Chair, of importance, from the usual areas of LTSM, admissions, learner transport. We're focusing quite sharply on the issues of COVID essentials, as the Minister indicated. Infections are surging, not only in Europe and other parts of the world. We've seen that in our own country, we've moved over 3 days from 1,000 to about 3,000 to increase in the infections. So we're getting ourselves ready for the reopening of schools in 2022. Indications are that we might be doing that probably shortly after the height of the fourth wave, because we've been told that we are likely to experience the fourth wave end of November, beginning of December. So without any waste of time, Chair, I'm going to humbly request that you allow Mrs. Geyer, the branch responsible for the coordination of provinces and also the coordination of schools to lead the presentation on the state of readiness for the 2022 academic year. Mrs. Geyer?
Thank you very much. Good morning, honorable members. This presentation, let me just try and get rid of this thing on my screen. Good morning, honorable members. This presentation is about the school readiness for the academic year, the extent to which we are able to get the information about our readiness. We'll go straight into the detail of the presentation. If we can move on to the next slide. So this just gives the outline of the presentation, but if we move on, the important part is the background that we need to just get some detail on. So the purpose of conducting the school readiness visits is to provide support to the schools and to identify any challenges that may impact on the effective teaching and learning at the beginning of each year. And what we try to do is to address promptly the various aspects that we pick up in terms of what our findings are from the school readiness monitoring. So we normally have these visits as a pre-closure monitoring in November of the previous year in preparation for the following year, but this year it's a bit difficult to do that because of the issues around COVID, and that it's a bit difficult for us to go out, and also that we wanted to allow that the schools are not disrupted too much with many visits from outside into the schooling environment. So as a result of that, we are now going to conduct school readiness visits from the 12th to the 18th of January 2022, God willing, if the virus conditions allow us to do that. That's where our plans are. The school visits include a sample of schools that are identified, and we draw from the poverty quintiles in the selected districts and circuits. And this includes all the types of schools like primary schools, secondary schools, combined schools, intermediate schools, special schools, small schools, and schools with boarding facilities. And it cuts across the spectrum of urban and rural schools in the country. So from there, we then have follow-up assessments. And these follow-up assessments include the issues that are picked up at the beginning of the 2022 academic year in the monitoring that was conducted. And then we do telephonic follow-up in weeks from the 28th to the 11th of March. And thereafter, we have a monitoring team that goes out to then address the issues that have been raised within these reports that come through. And the monitoring team includes the DBE officials as well as circuit managers or a circuit representative that has been assigned. We've sampled the districts, and so these are the districts that are to be visited in the 9 provinces based on the criteria that I have indicated earlier. If we move on to the areas that we are going to monitor, so we have identified the themes and we have broadened out on the themes to what we normally do school monitoring on. These themes include the COVID-19 protocols. We are also looking at the SASANs, which there are improvements that we have done to SASAN, so we are monitoring all of that. There are then the usual topics we have, which is the school admissions, the provision of teachers, the provision of LTSM, the curriculum management, the national school nutrition program, the infrastructure and the provision thereof, with an emphasis on safe water and sanitation and learner transport. There are areas that we have included which we don't normally have in our monitoring. That is the ICT coding and robotics. We, in the current context of COVID, we are also providing information there. We look at school safety, which is the theme that we normally also look at during our visits. And then the social cohesion and equity. There are areas now that we've had to identify in COVID that we also just provide information on. And also we are providing information on school sports and enrichment and the impact that COVID has had on that. So if we then move on to the COVID protocols, just to give you an update of that, the standard operating procedures is what the department has had. We've published this. It's available in all the schools and in all the on our website, and all the provinces have this information. And this is what guided us during all the period of the pandemic, and it continues to be the document that we work in terms of. There are no changes that have been effected to it since September 2020, and these are the requirements that apply as a protocol to all the schools in terms of you know, how you conduct yourself and what are the procedures in terms of orientation of learners and staff, and the school principals and the school governing bodies are responsible to ensure that this standard operating procedures are implemented. We're also just giving you information on the vaccine campaign. So we had a vaccine campaign that we, in the public service, we led by having the teachers all be vaccinated. We campaigned for them to be vaccinated. And that happened from the 23rd of June of this year, and it ended on the 8th of July. And during that time, we're just giving you the information of how many officials on per cell, 826,431 officials on per cell were vaccinated. And then the SGB funded personnel are included there. The independent schools are included there. The voluntary food handlers are included. And all of these people were registered on the database of the Department of Health, the EVDS, and then information was extracted from there, and that information then told us that there were 455,360 educated personnel that were vaccinated using the single dose of J&J vaccine, and these figures include the personnel who had already received the Pfizer doses before the vaccine started in education, and then there were also those who chose to vaccinate after this vaccine process. If we move on to the next slide then, we're just indicating that the Department of Health, around the 12 to 17-year-olds, they have released a statement, and they are vaccinating 12 to 17-year-olds. They've not started vaccinating any person under 12 years old. We follow the Department of Health protocols in this respect. The meeting that was held on the COVID vaccination focal persons, they have established an integrated school health program task team on this matter. And what the information that comes through from there is that the Department of Health will facilitate a meeting with the two ministers between the Department of Health and DBE to discuss the matter of the basic education minister. To release a statement around this, because there's lots of queries and lots of information that is being asked, especially around learners who are younger than 12 years old, but also on the protocols of the Department of Health in terms of how they administer the vaccine program. And currently the Department of Health is not vaccinating any children in schools, and any vaccination site in a school will require the consent forms to be signed by parents and guardians as directed in the policy in this integrated school health policy program. And any vaccination off-site will not require the integrated school health program consent forms, but they do encourage that learners vaccinate and that they bring their guardians or parents where possible when they go and vaccinate on an off-school site. The MAC then, just in terms of the COVID protocols, they are giving the recommendations. They have given it in July of this year, and these protocols still remain the advice from the advisory committee. So all the schools should open at full capacity was the advice. The primary school functioning on full school capacity basis should practice maximum feasible physical distancing between the learners, and ideally that all the learners should at least be 1 meter apart in the classrooms, and that where it's not possible, that the full capacity is still recommended to be commenced while maintaining a maximum feasible physical distance. So this was the advice that they gave around the issue of physical distance. The children should have mask breaks in relation to the full capacity and when we opening up of all the primary schools, and that these mask breaks should be every 2 hours, and that it has to entail going outdoors and removing the mask for approximately 5 to 15 minutes. In the high schools, the advice was that they can immediately resume full capacity of learning if the physical distance of 1 meter between the learners can be ensured. And where it's not possible, then the attendance of rotational basis should continue, and that this group was relatively at higher risk of getting COVID-19, and that that's what the reason why they had made this recommendation. And then the opening of secondary schools on the daily attendance should be phased in after the primary schools have been fully opened, and that the department should ensure that all the schools have the necessary PPEs as prescribed in the standard operating procedures. This is just to reiterate what the advice was that we got from the advisory committee, and that was what informed our decisions around how we proceeded in COVID to reopen schools where it was possible. Moving on to the next theme then, we are now looking at the e-administration of schools in terms of SSM. And here we are just providing you with the information around aligning the EMIS information system to support the data management at all levels in the education department. If you could move to the next slide, please. And it's important for the education sector to get this information, this data, because it helps us for planning and reporting on the performance of the sector in order to support the institutions and the policy changes that is needed around the schools, around the learners, around educator information, around academic performance, looking at the grade 12 NEC registration, and we are able to make plans based on that. So the data is collected, and then we analyze the data, and then we look at how to support and improve the performance of the schools and the institutions based on that analysis. And this has been very useful, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic period, and it helped inform our intervention that we did in the schools. So this standard data source also assists with the policy implementation and with monitoring of by the various officials in the either at the national level or the provincial level, and data validation rules that are built in on the source of application and the quality assurance process to support the data integrity and the completeness of the form of this information. And we just give you a diagram that shows you the source and the data flow of the data and how that actually works in terms of who is involved. So we have SSM's databases, and it also includes the independent schools as well as the public schools. And then it feeds from the 9 provinces, and they have a warehouse of of data, and that information is also used by us, as well as at a national level. We have LURIDS, we have BI, and then of course we look at the analysis of the NSC exam. And this feeds into reporting to Treasury. It reports on our school realities, which we publish on an annual basis. We report, we use this information to report to Parliament and any other sector reports that we need to compile, because this is then clean data that has been verified, and it gives us a reliable information of the sector. The next slide then just gives you the breakdown of the size of the data that's collected in EMIS on a quarterly basis. We tell you the number of schools we're collecting data from. We have the number of learners that we have information on, which includes daily attendance, and also looking at the various other information that we capture from the learners, from the educators in terms of who's at the school. And then all this information is verified. It's also, we work with the Department of
Recording stopped.
And we capture this information, and it's linked to the IDs, and there is a very good correlation.
Recording in progress.
So the next slide then just talks to the SSMs in terms of how it's managed in the application at the school level and the reliance of that information. So the DBE maintains the school administration application, and the schools are supplied free of charge, and there's currently 98.6 schools in the 8 provinces that are reporting on SSMs, and the WCED is the only province that doesn't use this. They have various other reporting tools that they collect data from in these schools. So we just also explain about the administration to assist schools and the reporting. And currently, the availability of the 2021 promotion school process can be registered in terms of new learners and generate the new class list that can be prepared, and new learners can be registered to in terms of attendance registers available. So this can lessen the burden of the teacher in terms of the administration that the teacher normally has to do, and that the school has to do from a planning point of view by generating these kinds of reports and class lists and so on, because at the beginning of the year, this normally, for those who have been teachers will know that that's normally a very time-consuming process that a teacher and a school has to facilitate. Then this information is updated, and the updates just explained in that block there how we actually go about the updating in terms of making sure that there's uniformity of policy implementation and standardizing reporting, and the extent to which that will assist the monitoring as well as the integrity of the reported data. And then the final is a SAMS update for the year is planned to include the subject complete assessment program for the following year. The risk, however, of that is that if it's not released on time, then it has an impact on, and if it's not done before the schools are closed, then it does affect the extent to which the planning and the operations of 2020 that we've explained in what all can be done on the program, it does have an impact on that. And so it then will affect, the extent to which it could be properly tested, and they could pick up on errors and so on before you could release any circular or amend any information. And then lastly, we just talk about the school notification, which is the EMIS circular that goes out, that went out and will go out in 2022 to inform the schools at the key points about the required data fields that need to be reported. And this includes learner biographical data, learner academic performance, educator and staff information, as well as the school and institutional information. Moving on then, we give you a slide that gives you information around what the system is that we have, and we explain what SSM's action planned in terms of that. So in terms of SSM's administration, the schools have to complete the 2021 promotions with reporting, and they have to capture and register and capture the new learners. They have to verify the current registrations, then create classes and generate class lists. They assign subjects and they prepare subject programs of assessment. And so this is very useful as I said, for the whole system to actually understand the information, analyze it, but the schools also benefit greatly from that. Then, of course, the regular thing which SASAM's data collection does is a 10-day snap collection, which is collected as on 31 January. And this is about the number of learners and the number of educators, the subjects, and the grade 12 NSC registration that is there, or that information is captured, so that we are able to look at the information. And then there's an annual school survey that's collected in March, and this is the information then that's verified and cleaned up, and this is what informs our standard reporting. Moving on to the next thing then, it's about learner admissions. Learner admissions then, we are just giving you in the slide here the provinces and when the admission periods were. So each province has got published admission dates that they have recorded, and that they then take in the new learners based on that. The issue around the status of undocumented learners, we have highlighted that in the next slide. Because we have, this is a matter that we have to continually speak to. It is about the right to education that must be extended to everyone in terms of our constitution, and that this includes undocumented South African or non-national children. And so we have then developed Circular 1 of 2020, which advises all the provincial departments and the schools about this court case that we had a judgment on, which is the Pakamisa judgment of the Eastern Cape. And this judgment has implications for undocumented learners that must be used as a point of reference. And the judgment and the circular directs in that all the provinces in the, in all of the education departments and all schools in South Africa have to align the admission rules and practices, to which includes school funding practices, in line with this judgment. So despite this judgment, and which we have communicated widely on, in our circular to the schools in 2020, there are still cases of learners that are being denied admission to the schools. And some of the interpretation was that this is an Eastern Cape province judgment in the High Court in the Eastern Cape, and therefore it's only relevant to undocumented learners in the Eastern Cape, which is not correct, and therefore we had to resend out again the circular, and to explain to the other provinces that this is applicable, this judgment holds for the entire country, and that all undocumented learners have the right to be having access to education, and that they should be allowed to attend. And so we're just reiterating the constitutional right that the learners have in terms of education. So just on the requirements then of evidence, proof of we have to account in terms of this particular court ruling and how we have interacted with it as a department. So we have redistributed we are involved in mediation of the circular of 1 of 2020, and there is a covering letter that we have sent out to clarify and further explain that to all the provinces. And all provinces and districts and circuits and schools have to familiarize themselves with the admission case law and to align the admission policies irrespective of the province, because that ruling is applicable to everyone. So then, if we move on, so the provincial preparations in terms of the activities, this slide just gives you a breakdown then of exactly what the provinces are involved with. They have a management plan in terms of the circulars that they provide on admissions of the learners, and then they also have different ways in which they communicate the admissions policy that is open, the management plan in terms of the times that we have indicated when they're going to do the admissions. They do that on through various ways. They have frequently asked questions. They have in some instances they have a link where you can access that information. Others utilize radio station and adverts, in terms of how they communicate that. And Largely provinces, they have a circular. The first thing is that the circular communicated, but secondly, they also have intensive communication campaign that covers this particular aspect of admissions in terms of the activities. So the next slide just gives you then the other provinces, because they have different strategies that they use in communication and how they get the information out through newsletters and some have flyers and some, you know, there's different ways of communication that people are utilizing, and they have active bi-weekly meetings of district admission teams, and in the provinces they're also tracking that in terms of making sure that everything is on track and that they are able to track the extent to which admissions is happening. The next slide, which follows then, gives you the breakdown of the number of placements in different provinces and the different grades in terms of the reception year, in terms of grade 1, going through to all the other grades right up until grade 12, in terms of all the placed learners and all the unplaced learners in each province. And we have got all the information in all the provinces based on what the unplaced learners are that they still need to mitigate before the schools reopen next year. So the challenges that relate to these unplaced learners is largely that they are late applications that create problems around, you know, how they can then find the placement of the places for these learners. And this is despite the massive advocacy campaign that, like I've said, the provinces used a lot of radio and media kind of communication. But despite that, you still have late applications. In some instances, these late applications are not are unavoidable because, firstly, you have the reason is that some parents would have ignored the closing dates. But you also have parents who gravitate, they migrate from rural communities and move to bigger cities. And then at the beginning of the year, they are looking for placement of their learner, of their children who need to get into the schools. Also, there are informal settlements that spring up around established communities, and then this creates an influx into the schools. And this is informal settlements are as a result of migration from rural to urban areas, and this is still a challenge that it makes it very difficult for planning because you are not able to predict the exact number of learners who are expected in the grades in the following year. And so in the planning, we cannot make the plans of additional mobiles or, you know, even timelessly to see that there's a problem, to see how to mitigate classroom space. And so this has all got an impact on how we manage our planning for schools. And this problem is in particular in large urban areas as a result of this migration. And that, like I said, it has an impact on the number of classroom space that we have. And it also has an impact on the number of teachers that we are able to provide and the number of textbooks that we have to provide. So these challenges we then have to see how to mitigate at the beginning of the year as they unfold. But then there's also problems around an expectation or a perception that English medium schools provide better quality of schooling. And so then there's a challenge that parents want to have their children registered in English medium schools, there isn't enough accommodation, and the same problems emerge around, you know, sufficient textbooks, sufficient teachers, and the classroom space to be able to offer for the number of English learners that are required in that area. It has an impact on that. So the insufficient space in schools in the urbanized areas, like I've explained, it has it still remains the biggest problem that we have, and it relates also to then how we manage on the infrastructural and the furniture, and there's a number of knock-on problems that emerge from that. There are tensions in relation to the challenges we're just highlighting. There are tensions between the rights of the SGBs to determine the admissions policy in terms of SASA and then the right of a parent to access to education at the school of their choice. And that in provinces where learners are admitted on a first-come and first self-serve basis, the local learners who do not apply on time, they experience problems of placement within the suburb that they live if you adopt this first-come, first-served basis. And the pre-closure assessment will then look at all of these challenges, and we will then mitigate the challenges based on that, especially in the provinces that are most affected by these problems, which is Gauteng and Western Cape. Moving on then to teacher provisioning. So this information is just giving you all the information about what is the requirements in the process of post-provisioning. So there are three critical processes that must be completed. The schools must receive their final post-establishment letters each year by 30 September according to the policy. And then they have to declare vacancies they must look at the profile of these vacancies, and they must prepare for the filling of these posts at the beginning of the year. And they have to prioritize the educators who are declared in excess or addition to the staff establishment, as we say, and then also the bursary graduates as well as the self-funded and the NSFAS graduates into these vacancies. So, I mean, the third criteria is that the schools have to declare the post in addition and the identification of the educators declared in addition, and that process should commence as soon as they receive the final establishment to ensure that the educators who are declared additional are immediately redeployed to schools that have matching vacancies. And this is a planning process that the department engages in on an annual basis. And then the monitoring that we do in terms of school readiness also looks at the extent to which there is compliance on the provisioning, especially in relation to norms and the processes and the time frames that had to be followed around this. Now, in relation then to the teacher provisioning, this is a snapshot of the provinces and how they have declared their post-provisioning, and you can see that all of them have already complied. They might not have all complied this year on the date that they were supposed to. The date was the 30th of September. Some have done it earlier than the 30th of September, but others have done it a little bit later. And the reason for that has been that there were some challenges that were experienced within those provinces. This is a consulted process between the unions, the trade teacher unions, and the department. And until such time as that process has been concluded, they cannot send out, the MEC cannot declare their post establishment. So these are the difficulties, but they have in this instance in all the provinces managed to declare their post establishment. Then, following that process, the second part in, as we said, on the provisioning of the how you're placing all the teachers that are qualifying from the university. So for purposes of auditing, we are compelled as a department to report on the Funda Lushaka graduates, because the state has invested money on these graduates. And in the past, because we did not track the reporting correctly, many, many years ago, we were then asked to focus on how we place Funza Lushaka graduates. These are not the only people we place, as we've explained earlier in the slide, but this just gives you an overview of the provincial departments and the number of potential graduates who are going to come out with the Funza Lushaka graduate bursary for 2021, and they will be coming out. If they graduate, there will be the newly qualified teachers coming into the school, and it gives you a grand total of 6,085 graduates from Funza Lushaka that's coming out. The percentage of teachers coming out is much higher than this, because there's also the NSFAS learners who have received bursaries, and we also place them, as well as those who are self-funded. Moving on to the next theme then, we are now talking to the LTSM, the procurement and the distribution process for 2022, and we have a catalogue that has been developed, and we just give you the details of the catalogue that has been developed and that which grades it covers and when it was released, and that it is still being implemented now, and what are the various areas that is covered in terms of folklore, for example, braille and large print, sign language, looking at the FET literature, and as well as what happens in the earlier grades, foundation phase and grade R, and also looking at the new subjects that we have introduced in terms of MSD, with the focus on technical math, technical science. electrical, mechanical, and civil technology, and these subjects are the STEM subjects that have been introduced and are implemented in 2016 to date. So on the procurement end, if you give the breakdown of the number of schools, so we are not just giving a state of readiness of what is happening in the provinces. They have a procurement model that they follow, and not all the provinces have the same procurement model in terms of uniformity. Some provinces choose to centrally procure to maximize on the economies of scale, and so they centrally procure textbooks, for example, for all the Section 20 and Section 21 schools. Other provinces prefer to procure the textbooks only centrally for the Section 20 schools, and for the Section 21 schools, they transfer the funds to the school and they allow the school to procure. And so this slide, just gives you the different examples of the provinces and what they have chosen to do. The same holds with the stationery. They have given information around the stationery that has been procured centrally for quintiles 1 to 3. And in quintiles 4 and 5, in some instances, the schools have not opted to be part of the central procurement. And the situation again here is about, in some instances, centrally procuring for only the Section 20 schools, and in other instances, they transfer the funds to the Section 21 schools, or they procure for both the schools, depending on what level they have taken. So the breakdown is just, if we can just move through all the provinces and move on to the slide that talks to the retention and retrieval. So this is just a slide that talks to the percentage of where we are at in terms of retention and retrieval. You'll see that there is a high percentage that most provinces hold in terms of how they are able to retain and retrieve the books. And then in terms of whether they've reached universal coverage on that, this percentage just gives you that breakdown again of problems. Then the state of readiness in terms of RTSM for 2022. So here we're giving you the details of, the top-up of the textbooks that they have to provide, the stationery in terms of how the procurement process is going there. In some instances, they have completed the deliveries, and the provinces are at a 100% readiness in terms of the delivery of the textbooks, as well as where they are at with the provision of the stationery. In other instances, we are giving you information in the provinces that tell you the extent to which, especially around the stationery, the extent to which where they are at with the process of procurement. There were some difficulties that had, in some instances, they had to have the procurement process completed by a certain time, but because there were some difficulties related to the procurement process and that they couldn't award the contracts to those who had put in application for that tender, so then they had to then go back and either redo the process, or some people were excluded because of the difficulties and the problems that were experienced based on the information that's there. The details of all of this is provided in these slides to give you the exact reasons and where they are. And then in terms of where we are at for the anticipated date of delivery, so most of the anticipated date for delivery is in November, but you can see that when you look at the stationery slide, a column that is just in the middle there, you'll see that in some instances, although the anticipated date was November, the delivery is already in October was completed, and so they in that instance, they are now ready as a province to receive the learners and provide textbooks and stationery for the 2022. Yeah, it just provides for the detail of each province, and I won't go into each province slide as it goes. So if we move on then to the challenges and how we are mitigating it, So for each of these areas, we have to look at what exactly the challenge is, because we have a responsibility to ensure that provinces, the textbooks, the stationery, the braille and the large print and all of that is provided to the schools timely, to allow for the academic year to start without interruption. And so we are just indicating here per province what are some of the challenges that they have experienced, which made it difficult for them to proceed timely with their planning. And largely you can see it's around either that they had some difficulties around the procurement processes, or they had difficulty on budgets that they had to see how to manage that. There were some tensions maybe in some instances around school governing body and the school RTSM committee in terms of the procurement of the textbooks, where the school is actually taking responsibility to order the textbooks. But in each of these cases we have tracked it, because we have these meetings on a monthly basis with the provinces. There are LTSM committees, and it's cascaded down to the district level as well as to the school level. And in those committees, they then track the progress, and we are able to put in place mitigation plans around exactly what is the problem and how to avoid that this problem escalate to a problem of not having the textbooks delivered. And so you'll see against each of these problems and challenges that we have explained what the mitigation is to avoid there's a problem on the delivery. The same goes for the stationery, the same for in the braille. There are no problems that have been recorded there. And the same with the SAE cell, there's no real problems that we have recorded there. But where there were problems around the textbooks and stationery, we have indicated what we have done. And we feel comfortable that we will not have any problems when the schools are open based on the way in which we track this. Where there are extreme difficulties that are experienced, we also physically go into that province and we work with the province to ensure that the delivery does happen. If we then move on to the curriculum management of this report, we are just giving information here around what is happening on the ICT rollout and the coding and robotics. So because of COVID, we've had to look very carefully at how we manage the ICT rollout, but also how we manage that there's access to this information, and we give this to you here. So there is more and more what we have looked at is having available state-owned digital content resources, which we are then able to provide to everyone, and we do this with partners who have partnered with us to help us to be able to develop this material. So we have 1,100 titles of state-owned content resources. This consists of textbooks, state-owned textbooks on the high enrollment subject, and we have 137 titles that we have state-owned textbooks on. We've also got the workbooks, and we indicate that that's also in a digital form, as well as we have the graded readers and the big book for the foundation phase, and it is in 11 languages, so that is accessible to those who want to use that format. And we have also the Mind the Gap study guides in 24 titles that we make available to assist the matriculants. And all of this information is available on PDF, it's on EPUB, and also you can have it available on the HTML5 drive in terms of how you can get that information. So we, on the next slide, we're just giving you examples of the actual online content resource portals that we have available. So we have, these are all free online content resources that are available. We give you the DBE zero rated support packages, and the information we are sharing in terms of the links. These links are all available on our website, but they also are on the provincial department's websites. And we also use other methods of communication through the TV, through the social media, through various other platforms and apps that we have, we make all of this information available, especially for learners who require support. And in particular, this has helped us a lot during the COVID period in instances where we needed to have that happen. Where we cannot have that because of the network connectivity not being available in rural areas, or where the learners do not have access to the devices, we still resorted to the hard copies of all of this information. And so learners could come to school and fetch the packages, or parents could come to school and fetch the information, or on the days when they came to school on rotation, they were provided with this. Here is the further information to show you the online content resources of the DBE that and how it's set out on our server. So you can just see the usefulness of how to navigate this particular link. And then we have the DBE Cloud. We also show you that in terms of how you can navigate various information and how it is packaged around making it user-friendly to teachers and learners and parents, and you know, what exactly it is around which category, like ECD, there's information there, there's information for administrators and so on. Then we move on and we also give you other information about the PED. So it's not only the DBE that's working on this. Over and above what we have done at the DBE, the provinces have also worked on a lot of developing of content portals, and we're just giving you the examples of those who have information that educational resources on video lessons, apps, ebooks, interactive revision material, assessments, and teaching plans. And we give you the indication of the portals and the platforms and so on that you can see what the provinces are doing. We also have some partners that we have developed resources with, resource portals with, and we're giving you the information. Our main partners are the MTN Foundation, Siyabula Foundation, the Vodacom Digital Classroom, the Telkom e-Education, and the MTN Yellow Ed platform, which we are recording the various websites that you can visit, and this is educational material that can be downloaded for nothing. And then moving on to the zero rating educational website. So we're just giving you all the educational websites here, the various PED, DBE portals and school websites, and this is all free information. Some of it is even provided free from the private sector to the portals, and this has all helped to be able to support learning, especially in our difficult times of the pandemic. Going on to the virtual classrooms then. So these virtual classrooms is a partnership that has been developed between the DBE ICASA, the Department of Communications and Digital Technology, and then the mobile network operators who will implement the virtual classroom solution. And there are 17 schools. So this is a total virtual classroom solution that's provided. And we give you an indication of the overview of number of schools that have been identified to the various providers, and they are funding the total provision from you know, their funds. So going forward then, these virtual classroom solutions will provide to the grade 12 learners ICT devices, connectivity, training and technical support for a 17-month period. And the teachers will be trained on how to use the solution, and Vodacom, MTN Telkom, and Liquid Telkom have finalized the connectivity solution in the schools. MTN, RAIN, and Telkom have also delivered the learner devices, and they've installed a virtual classroom solution to the selected schools. So that's good progress that we have made there. And we're grateful for the support we got from these providers. So moving on then to the next area, which is about coding and robotics, and in particular to look at 4IR and skills for a changing world. So of course the background to this is just that ASANA commitments for both 2019 and 2020 have highlighted that we, the President has said in his State of the Nation address that we want to have a framework of skills for a changing world. And we want to expand the training of both educators and learners to respond to the emerging technologies that include the Internet things and robotics and artificial intelligence. And that's the reason why we then need to expand on introducing subjects like coding and robotics and data analytics and to improve the education system to develop skills that we need for the future. And this was reiterated again in the introduction in the 2020 SANA commitments of the introduction of coding and robotics from grades R-3 in 200 schools, and that we will phase this in going forward. So these digital skills are important, and it's about how we look at providing, you know, not only the skills, but these a combination of behaviors, expertise, and know-how that learners need to have, work habits, characteristic traits, dispositions, and critical understanding of exactly what a new world in the 21st century skills are required in terms of digital skills and computational thinking, and also to look at innovations and other soft skills. And so the purpose of introducing coding and robotics is having a framework for the curriculum is then to focus on taking our learners along with us on that. So the background then just gives you all of that information. Going forward into the next slide, on slide 56, we have the objectives and the purpose of coding and robotics. And yeah, we're giving you further detail of what we want to try and achieve out of this. So I've explained, you know, that we need a curriculum and that we have developed a curriculum with key competencies, and that this is in a stage of rollout, in the early stages of rollout, and that, you know, in our school that we are piloting. And the purpose then is just to look at how we develop the learners to be able to solve problems, think critically, work collaboratively and creatively, and to use different functions in digital and information, in a digital information-driven world, but also to look at computational thinking skills to support coding, as well as all other subjects, and to apply these digital skills and the transfer of these skills to solve everyday problems, as well as to develop a new generation of creative, innovative, and system thinkers that can use coding to express their ideas, and that this can become, you know, the pool of learners that come out of school and are able to then take up a career path and assist the country in the areas that we require, where these skills are needed in industries, and that they become, we're developing a culture of being more self-directed, and that we have lifelong learners. So the next slide can just give you a breakdown of our digital skills program curriculum for grade R to 9. And this is in particular focusing on coding and robotics curriculum with the various pillars. There are four pillars that it's built on: an application of skills, internet and e-communication skills, data and information management skills, computational thinking skills, and coding. And then it gives you some details of what exactly in each of these pillars it covers, which I'll not get into detail of. But to say that there is progress that we have made, in the next slide we are giving you the report on. So the curriculum, we had a team of the minister gazetted the draft caps for coding and robotics for grade R to 9, and it was open for public comment in March 2021. And we did receive lots of comments, from about 50 public comments that were received, and we considered it. But also that Umalusi had to appraise the curriculum, which they did, and then they forwarded an evaluation report that asked us to do some repackaging of certain areas of the curriculum, and that we had to resubmit the curriculum and assessment policy statements you know, to them after we have repackaged it. So we have a task team that has repackaged it and directed it to Umalusi to be finalized. So the state of readiness then, in terms of how we are moving on this curriculum, to implement this curriculum, is that we have a service provider that has conducted an audit to assess the teacher digital capabilities, the availability of laptops, the network coverage, and the connectivity in the provinces and the schools that are to be piloted for coding and robotics. And 9 provinces have established the project management teams, which consist of the curriculum, the teacher development, the MST grant section, the inclusive education section, infrastructure, and safety directorates to coordinate the implementation of the coding and robotics when it is going to be implemented full time. And then there's also large scale advocacy that we need to do around this, which has happened in March to May of 2021. and that the DBE coding and robotics team has conducted this advocacy in the 9 provinces through roadshows, and they have visited the 52 districts and interacted with 494 officials, as well as 885 principals of the identified schools that have been piloted. Then furthermore, if you look at just the breakdown of what we're giving on the curriculum implementation, this is just useful information that gives you more detail about orientation of the grade R-3 and 7 orientation, and grade R-4-6 and 8 orientation, and the progress that has been made in terms of what we've done on LTSM provision, the piloting schools that we have piloted in, and in terms of grade R-3 on the 200 schools there, and grade 7 on the 1,000 schools there, that we have a guideline for implementing coding and robotics, which is in its final stage. And then we have the monitoring as well that we have to monitor, and we indicate how we have actually proceeded in monitoring the various provinces that are involved. So this next slide gives you some interesting photos just to showcase some of what we have done in terms of the piloting schools, and that there's lack of resources in some schools, but you can see how the learners group together in these photos. Just useful showcasing so that you can see how it's unfolding in our schools. There are challenges that we are experiencing. Of course, we have indicated that the funding to procure coding and robotics resources in the PEDs remain a problem. The scheduled time in the school timetable for the teaching of coding and robotics, we have to have this as a dedicated subject, you need scheduled time, and we'd have to look at how we manage that in a timetable, because it would bring about an additional amount of time that we have to factor in, as well as a service provider to conduct the training for the grade R has not yet been appointed. And then the schools monitored have shown the following challenges. So the shortage of coding and robotics and IT resources we mentioned, it's as a result of the funding. And then the network connectivity for teaching and learning, which is not always there, depends on how rural the area, but there are other network connectivity problems, which is outside of our realm in the Department of Education, and will remain a challenge. There are security problems in terms of procured resources, and then the teacher resources in terms of lesson plans and teacher guides also remain challenges. And then our future plans in terms of coding and robotics curriculum implementation. So yeah, we just identified the teacher orientation started on the 4th to the 8th of October of this year, and PEDs are currently orientating their grade 4, 6 and 8 teachers. And in the development of the exemplar assessment tasks and guidelines, and development of guidelines responding to learner diversity of CAPS documents. So the DBE then will be piloting the curriculum of grade R to 9 as follows. We just give you the breakdown per year of which grades we will be piloting, so that by 2024 we would hopefully be in full implementation. Moving on then to another theme, we are now on the school nutrition program. And the slide just gives you information about how we are managing that. So we have a very well-established nutrition program that runs in the provinces, and the DBE and oversees all of that. So the funds are transferred to the schools and the procurement happens. It's a decentralized procurement model that we have, where we transfer the last tranche in December. And this is to make sure that they are being ready for preparing for the nutrition program to run in January. The contracts are all in place for the delivery of the food and fuel to ensure that the schools are able to pick up on the nutrition program in January, as well as food deliveries and adequate supply in stock is available, and it's ready to be delivered. The food, the volunteer food handlers, daily attendance to prepare the meals. They go out into the schools and they cook the meals there. And then we have an NSNP committee in place that ensures the operational compliance and functionality. And we monitor in terms of the scheme, and that they monitor to ensure the feeding happens on the first day of school, and that any questions that are there in terms of the feeding, they cover it directly and using a monitoring tool, and that's how they gain information on the ground. besides of doing the actual physical monitoring. The next area of theme is the infrastructure, water, sanitation, furniture, and scholar transport. Yeah, which is on infrastructure, we are explaining that, you know, with this, for the schools, in preparation for the schools to reopen in 2022, we have to look at what the identified risk areas are, and we have to make sure that the provinces provide the remedial actions to ensure that these are mediated against, and to ensure that teaching and learning can commence when the schools reopen. So new schools have to be completed, you know, the progress of the completion has to be timed for readiness of occupation when the schools reopen. Then there are renovations and repairs that need to happen in terms of infrastructure, and then the renovations have to progress to ensure that everything is ready for when the school opens, and that it's ready for occupation at that point. And then there's also campaigns for cleaning of the schools, so that this is time for the reopening of the schools and the school is cleaned by the time that the school reopens. There's areas of storm damage and vandalized schools, which happens. Storm damage can happen any time, and vandalism of school is prone to happen over the school holidays. But where that happens, there are contingency plans in the case of storm damaged schools during the holidays to ensure that schooling is not disrupted. And then the Department of Basic Education and Treasury and the National Disaster Management Center collaborate in improving the process flow and the turnaround period for rehabilitating the facilities in the case of natural disaster. And then we also have to ensure that all the vandalized schools are rehabilitated and made habitable when the schools reopen. There are, in the areas of infrastructure, classroom shortages, and here we have to identify which schools are experiencing problems or are likely to experience overcrowding, and to provide temporary relief. It relates back to the admission slides, which speak to this and about how we do planning. And then the plans have to be provided and be in place for mobile classrooms, which respond to the demographic shifts and the population movements that we encounter. Then there are infrastructure hotspots, and the provinces have to identify these hotspots so that we know where there's an influx of learners and what the plans are for the temporary accommodation, and they work together to ensure that we then provide relief around mobile classrooms or whatever other temporary relief can be found to accommodate in these hotspots. Maintenance is an ongoing area that we have to look at, and then we have to improve that the implementation of maintenance of the infrastructure facilities. There's a stipend and there's a grant that we manage it from, and it's done per province, and they have allocated maintenance projects that come from this grant. And so the tracking of that and how that, you know, is on a steadily basis used to maintain our schools, that is what the provinces are busy with on an ongoing basis. And then there's an incentive allocation on the EIG that is being implemented to incentivize qualifying provinces to address immediate challenges such as the norms and standards and maintenance, and this is done according to the maintenance guidelines that we have implemented. So if we move on now in terms of how this plays itself out, so ACD has an inappropriate structured tracking kind of table that they give information on, and in terms of the ACD, they're just giving you the breakdown there of the total number of schools, the planning and the design, the tenders that were there, the construction and the level of, you know, the completion that it's at, and it covers areas of inappropriate structures, water supply and sanitation. And this just gives you then, in relation to inappropriate structures, what the status quo is. The next slide talks in the same way to the water supply and what the progress is in terms of that breakdown there. You can just have a look at those figures as a matter of interest. And then we talk on the safe sanitation, and it's the same information that we are providing then in terms of the progress per school, and you know, what the circumstances are around that summary. Then the next area then is talking to school furniture, and yeah, we have to look at the availability of the school furniture. We have to look at the repairs and rehabilitation. So these are all planning or programs that we have in place. Like in the case of repair and rehabilitation, we have relationships and memorandum of agreements with other departments like environmental affairs, labor, and correctional services. And they either build new furniture for us or they rehabilitate old and damaged school furniture, and then the provinces have participating contracts with these departments. The school furniture specifications, and we have to ensure that the South African standards, Bureau of Standards norms apply here in terms of the correct specifications, and that the service providers do adhere to those, and that there is an interprovincial task team then that looks at all of this. So on school furniture then, this next slide just gives you an indication of a flow chart of the delivery process, you know, in terms of what is happening and how we coordinated on the months, how it happens when we are in the planning phase, when we are in the procurement phase, when we look at implementation. And these are ongoing things that happen in a flow chart in the provinces that we monitor and we look at for compliance. Moving on then to learner transport. So learner transport is another area of importance to ensure for the school readiness, for the school to start, that learners have who need to be transported to school, they have the available transport, and that the plans are in place to ensure that this learner transport is available at the reopening of schools. And this includes continuing efforts to maintain road safety programs, focusing on learner transport operators, parents and learners, and to raise an awareness about road safety and law enforcement to ensure that our learners are able to travel to school safely, and that there are no accidents on the road or no unforeseen circumstances that happen. And so we have to look at the extent to which you know, we are involved where we can, but this is done by the Department of Transport, and they have their own contracts that they enter into with the service providers that provide this facility to this service for them. But where the parents are providing it, then, you know, or they have operators who do that, there are some privately private arrangements as well, but and from our side, we're not really involved in that to ensure that we take responsibility for the parents and the private operators. But it is a task of the province, you know, to provide the transport. We track it according to the arrangements with the Department of Transport and what the policy, especially around COVID as well, and the protocols that had to be introduced in COVID. So learner transport then on the slide 75 gives you the breakdown of exactly what the provincial needs are, how many learners there are who are in need of being transported, and the number of schools that are participating in that per province. And what the targets are in terms of, you know, where they want to take it to, around the number of learners who should be transported and schools that they want involved. In some instances, they have exceeded the targets. In other instances, they have not. And there is progress around that as well, around learner transport that we are giving in that slide. Then we also give a similar slide, which is around learners with special education needs who have to be transported. And we give it a per quarter in terms of the, and we also look at various aspects here, because this is a more difficult area of needs by learners who need to be transported with special needs. And so the breakdown gives you the number of learners who are in need, the number of schools who need it, and then we give you the percentages of the targeted learners and the number of learners who are, the progress of the number of learners who are currently being transported, and the number of schools. In some instances, it's more than what we had originally planned. You know, you can see that the needs are increased, and so there were adjustments that were made in relation to the special education needs and transport of learners there. So the learner transport, the desired outcomes which we strive towards is to ensure that this time is delivery of service, that these learners are transported to school on time and that they are fetched on time and get taken home again, that the road accident rate is reduced, that there are no accidents that involve these learners in as far as what we can plan, you know, and ensure that there's information and education around. And it requires a coordinated approach in terms of how we do our planning and implementation to ensure that the learner transport operators adhere to the traffic regulations, that the vehicles are maintained in terms of a maintenance plan and technical support for emergencies, that there is viable and sustainable operations, that there is uniformity of service and tariff structures, and that there is a coherent performance and monitoring system in place to monitor all of this. Then on the school safety theme, which is the next theme that follows there, So we are just giving you information around school safety. There is monitoring that happens on an ongoing basis, and they have for quarter 1 to 3, they have monitored 60 districts out of the 75 districts that they had to cover, and the monitoring done, and they are looking at implementation of the National School Safety Framework, and extent to which this is operational, you know, within the context of the provinces, and that this school safety committees that have to be established, that they are the critical levers to ensure that there is a safe learning environment, because they are promoting the safety of the school, but also that the learner retention and the achievement of learning outcomes happen. The risk management and implementation of the Occupational Health and Safety Act has to be prioritized in the schools, and so this is part of the work that they do, and there's a need to improve the emergency and evacuation plans in respect of that that they've picked up. In terms of the response to the disaster and risks identified through the risk assessment reports that have been generated in preparation for school readiness. So there's also training that needs to happen, and training that has happened in particular involving educators on drug testing and the updating of the first aid toolkits, which is critical. And so this is all what we have done up until now. And the districts have reported a lack of training in a number of schools on the NSSF and the protocols for managing and reporting sexual abuse and harassment. And there's a need to fast track the modernization of the SSMs to include maximizing the use of data to inform the planning and programming of these areas that have been identified, especially with the view to looking at gender-based violence and sexual harassment and abuse, that can help us to get data very quickly and to know how to put in place interventions. The school fencing needs to be prioritized to ensure the security of the learners, educators, and staff, including the infrastructure. And the department has to identify the need for continuous training of educators on a positive discipline, as well as the inculcation of human rights-based culture of learning environments and school communities. Now, then they talk about in the next slide, the section is just giving you information about the extent to which on school safety, the roadshows that they've had on violence and bullying, to look at the prevention initiatives that they have implemented, and they give you, they tell you the extent to which the DBE has rolled out these roadshows, and that the minister and the deputy minister have been involved in utilizing the multi-sectoral and interdependent departmental approaches to address the scourge of violence in the schools, including the bullying and cyberbullying, as well as to look at gender-based violence, and to look at gangsterism, and to see how we can actually mitigate these social ills that spill into the school environments and hamper the safety of the school environment. Going forward then on school safety, looking at violence and bullying prevention, they're just giving you what are the objectives of the program, and on the next slide on slide 82, and what the objectives are in terms of how they wish to mold learners. This is part of our vision that we want for our learners in the school, molding of the learners to be noble and respectful citizens with high self-esteem and environmental awareness. to also look at providing psychosocial support in order to prevent and to address helplessness, frustration, depression, anxiety resulting from bullying, as well as the emphasis on parental involvement, as well as strong partnerships and networks to be strengthened and utilized for maximum reach. Now, the last area then and theme that we want to cover is on social cohesion and equity. And this is just giving you information about since the advent of COVID-19, that we had to have introduced more of the social cohesion programs differently. We always had them in the department, but they were suspended because we could not conduct these programs on a face-to-face level. But in 2021, there was some modification, and we then had hybrid formats that with reduced participation of numbers, and we were able to explore some programs which included the National Schools Moot Court, Inkosi Albert Tuli Lutuli Oral History Program, the Youth Citizens Action Program, the Democracy Education Program, Girls and Boys Education Movement, and National Schools Debating Program and National Youth Camp. So these were some of the hybrid formats that we were able to introduce on these particular programs. In 2022, then, the DBE will look at how we can further bring face-to-face activity if the environment of the COVID protocols and the infections rate allow, God willing, that we are then able to have, again, face-to-face, but also online delivery, in terms of how these challenges can be mitigated and how we can introduce various opportunities to provide such relief, because our learners need this. They need the area of social cohesion and how we can do nation building, but also how we can just provide opportunity for learners to interact in the way in which they should be interacting in a normal circumstance. COVID has come along and made it very difficult for us, but we will look at how we can continue to provide those opportunities. The school enrichment programs, which is part of the social cohesion area, is also then to look at how we can, after COVID 19 has impacted so badly on providing support and enrichment programs in the schools, how we can then look at in 2022 to introduce that. And we found that a lot of the sporting activity and the enrichment programs were either cancelled in 2021, and that all that the various peak of the waves that we had and a severe impact, that made us have to suspend or cancel these programs. And because they really are part of a holistic development of the child, we have to look at how we, as a department, we then look at how we revise the directions to impact firstly on to allow the schools to resume with the school sport enrichment programs, but also how we can look at further opportunities to monitor and to ensure that there's a safe way in which we can resume and reboot these learning support programs within a COVID context within our schools for 2022. This is then the recommendations that we bring in this report on school readiness to the portfolio committee, in as far as we were able under the COVID environment to conduct and check that there is a school readiness for 2022, that is, that our schools are ready to start. And it is a very detailed report that has covered all the areas. Thank you very much, Honourable Members and Honourable Chairperson.
No, thank you very much, Ms. Gaya. Members, that's the presentation on the school readiness, a very long one, very detailed. Report. Can I note hands? I am seeing the hand of Honorable Nodada. Lizia. Open the world. Dr. Simbekwayo. Ntate Morwa Tsehla, In that order, can I give you Nodada? Honorable Nodada?
Thanks, Chair. Can I just check, Chair, my audible, Chair?
Yes.
Thanks, Chair. Thank you so much for the presentations, for the presentation on the school readiness for the year 2022. I just have a several questions, Chair, under each category that was presented today, and hopefully, you know, you'll bear with me just a little while. The first thing is that we obviously have seen in the previous or this current year that there was quite a few pushbacks in terms of the reopening of schools and, you know, waiting for the scientific and medical advice from the Ministerial Task Team responsible for that. And obviously, having learned from that, we need to obviously plan ahead. So maybe in case I missed it, Chair, because I joined again, you know, 10 minutes into the meeting. When are schools scheduled to reopen for 2022? Based on the advice that has been given that primary and high schools can fully open, so long as they've got the ability of the 1 meter distance. And in cases where they can't do that, then they can use the rotational system. So is there a specific date that has been earmarked or a timetable that, you know, has been drafted, to foresee when schools will reopen, you know, having known when, you know, the exams will be concluded, when, you know, results will be announced? Is there a forecasted date for that? Secondly, in terms of schools being COVID compliant, has there been an assessment done by provinces to look at the schools that were not maybe COVID compliant in the beginning of this year and see how to mitigate any of those challenges to ensure that they're COVID compliant for them to be able to or be eligible to reopen? So has that study been done to check whether, you know, these schools that were not COVID compliant across all provinces are now COVID compliant, meaning they've got access to water as their first line of defense? They've got the necessary PPE and so on. And will schools now be procuring their own protective equipment, or are provinces going to provide that particular support? And if they're procuring their own equipment with the stringent budget and the cuts that have been made now, will they be, you know, procuring those from their own budget, or is there supplementation from DBE or the relevant provincial departments? My third question, Chair, in fact, my fourth question, how many teachers and staff have been fully vaccinated now? Because the presentation indicates how many people took the J&J vaccine, but it doesn't indicate those that took Pfizer, how many of them are there? And what is the remainder of teachers that are unvaccinated or not vaccinated, as well as a staff component that is not vaccinated, broken down for each province, district, and circuit? And the reason why I ask this is because there's a large discussion around, you know, whether there will be vaccination passports. And has the department had that discussion on whether teachers will be required to have a vaccination passport for them to come and teach? Or is there another mechanism put in place to encourage and communicate and run campaigns that will encourage teachers and staff in schools to vaccinate so that we can return to some form of normality? And I ask this question because it's key, especially moving forward, as to what happens in schools and our reopening of schools, making sure that we try and curb that, that virus itself. Moving on to the school admissions, it's quite clear that Gauteng, you know, continuously has a challenge in terms of this, and that they've been cited the reasons as to what the case would be in terms of learner placements and why learners are not fully placed. And I see that the Western Cape and the Eastern Cape also has quite a, you know, high numbers of unplaced learners. Is there a specific timeline in which we could maybe get a report, Chair, that, you know, that will indicate maybe before, you know, the close of the year, or in the beginning of the year as to what strategies have been put in place to try and mitigate this challenge of unplaced learners and what the numbers will look like, particularly in those three provinces that I've identified that seem to have quite high numbers. And I don't know, there could be more, but especially in Gauteng, which is a consistent problem there. And what strategies are being put in place, and how could maybe the other provinces that might have a similar challenge draw strength from Gauteng and be able to mitigate that challenge? Linked with that, there was a presentation around undocumented learners. And we had a written question sent to the Minister of Basic Education that indicated that there are over 800,000 learners that are undocumented. 70% of them are actually South African learners. Is there a partnership or relationship with the Department of Home Affairs to vigorously try and deal with this issue of learners being undocumented? Because, I mean, it's got a lot of implications to it, whether it's linked to social development, whether it's linked to the education system itself. And having done this, having compiled all of this information and having this judgment that has been presented from the Eastern Cape, have we done research to check whether this undocumented learners are linked to the very high dropout rate that we have in the system? And, you know, what measures are being put in place for these two things? One, making sure that the undocumented learners get the necessary assistance to be documented. And number two, that we are able to monitor whether they are, you know, part of the large group that drops out or not. And how do we then best mitigate that challenge, you know, to try and avoid creating more youth not in education, employment, or training? Moving on to the provisions of teachers, I saw in the presentation that there was indicated that not budget, you know, budget hadn't been allocated at the time to look at the full staff complement for provinces and schools so that they can know exactly what to budget for in terms of the staff complement. Has that process now been finalized? And based on the budget cuts that have been made, looking at the fiscus, are we losing any vacancies that needed to be filled? And, you know, are we at full capacity in ensuring that at least the necessary teaching, quality teaching takes place in the different provinces? I hope my question is clear on this one. And then on curriculum, Chair, a lot of schools that we visited earlier this year when we were doing our national tour, as the reps in this portfolio committee, had indicated that it would be practically impossible to complete the curriculum with the rotational system. And I think that has been proven over time. And obviously, we're not going to recover this curriculum over a day, over 10 years. It's going to take quite some time to do that. I just wanted to check with the department that in terms of the curriculum coverage, there are specific areas that are linked to economic outcomes. When one goes through schooling so that we don't add to the high unemployment rate. And coding and robotics is one of them. But there are also districts that specialize in things like maritime, aviation, entrepreneurship, and some critical skills that are needed for the economy. Can we just get an undertaking that when you do these oversight visits like you've indicated to OR Tambo, for example, OR Tambo West, which you've indicated, you know, that's Port St. John's, Lusikisiki, which are based practically in the maritime space. Can we, maybe increase what we're monitoring to also look at the critical subjects that are new into the curriculum that will enhance, you know, the economic outputs so that we get a fully fledged report, not just on coding on robotics that has been piloted, but the entrepreneurship that has been piloted, maritime, aviation, which are specialized schools, if I can put it that way. So that we get a full picture of, you know, what activities are taking place on the ground. And I think maybe we should also do our own oversight as a portfolio committee in this regard. Secondly, in terms of curriculum, there are schools that have been indicated to be 0% pass rate schools. And they've been documented, and I think there were 18 of them this year. Is there any oversight that has been done in those schools, any support that has been given to those schools to ensure that they actually meet curriculum standards and maybe try and improve their results? If they are, are they also going to be monitored moving into the new year of that. And then lastly on curriculum, there was a question that has been put on online schooling and home school policy. And there were various presentations done in terms of what has been done by television, accessing online materials, particularly for coding and robotics, and various presentations that were given that these are the methods that we use to try and support curriculum coverage. But part of the challenges that we've picked up in KZN, Limpopo, the Eastern Cape in particular, some parts of the Free State, Northwest, is a very large challenge in terms of network, DG. And there's one school that the minister and the DG visited in Zwelitsha Junior Secondary School in Mount Frere, which practically is a blind spot for network, and learners have to go literally to the mountain to access some of these sites, because that's where the only place they can find network, even though they struggle with data and other things. But if these sites are zero rated and you don't have network, it becomes a challenge. Have we done a study of how many schools have been affected by network coverage issues that might prevent learners living in those areas being able to access these zero rated sites for them to be able to continue learning or getting more curriculum coverage besides the slots that have been given to radio, television, and otherwise? Then second, lastly, Chair, it's on safety and security. There are repeat incidences, particularly in Gauteng, you look at Cosmo City, in various parts in Gauteng, of syndicate attacks on safety and security. And this was a large discussion at length when we did our oversight post the looting and vandalism that took place in KZN and Gauteng. I just wanted to check, now since we're going to school holidays, because school holidays are also quite a target for criminals and syndicates and people that actually vandalize schools, have we developed the circuit and district-based and provincial-based safety and security plan to ensure that we don't have repeat incidences of violence, looting, or stealing in schools, and ensuring that the facilities themselves are actually protected at this point in time? There are specific schools that I would like to send to you that have fencing issues that prevent, you know, the safety and security mechanisms that are that need to be put in place. But my broad question is there a plan that has been put in place with SAPS and the relevant security cluster to ensure that now that we're going to school holidays, that these particular facilities have been protected so that we are able to use them in the new year, so that we don't use more money that we're supposed to use in eradicating pit toilets and mud schools into basically renovating schools that were vandalized or targeted by syndicates. Then my second last point is on infrastructure, Chair. Maybe let me just pause quickly on school nutrition. There's a school called Navelsig High School in the Free State, which has been deemed as a Quantile 5 school, but has housed over 200 learners that come from what we call Quantile 1 areas. Now, the school nutrition program, the way that it's designed to, to give support based on the quintile system. And I think, my colleague Desiree raised this, I think, two meetings ago, that there's a need for us to relook at this quintile system, because you find that, yes, the school is a quintile 5, but the learners that actually go to that school might not necessarily be able to afford for their own meals and so on, but they've been placed there because, you know, there's not enough space, for example, in the place that they come from, or they've chosen that particular school because they're trying to fill gaps in other places. And it's important for us to look at this intricately, because this is linked to the school nutrition program as well as scholar transport. Navelsig is just one example, because those learners haven't been getting any school nutrition because they're in a Quantile 5 school, but they get scholar transport to come and bring them to the school because they can't access the schools in the location that, you know, they necessarily come from. And at the end of the day, they then suffer the consequences of being categorized as a Quantile 5 school. I think something that we need to look at, and maybe if I can get a response on that. Then on infrastructure, Chair, there are specific projects that have been listed and cited. I think my views are known regarding my biggest challenge with the implementing agents not completing or not doing their work. Are there any schools that are going to be affected? Because I see the project, some of them are 25% completion, some at 75% completion, and a minute group of them actually can be completed before the new academic year starts. You know, can we maybe get a full report of the breakdown of when are these projects, particularly on ACDI and SAFE, going to be completed in terms of building the schools, the toilets that need to be eradicated and so on? Not just, you know, say, you know, this one is at so many projects are at 25% completion. I don't even know what that means, but can we get a full detailed breakdown? There are 286 schools. Of these 286 schools, 100 of them will be completed in March or whatever the case may be, based on whatever projected timelines there are. And we must be able to list those schools and what they are so that we can, as members, go and do oversight in those areas to ensure that the necessary work is being put in place. And then there are specific schools that I would like to cite on infrastructure, because there's a lot of talk about renovations here and schools of overcrowding. So there's quite a few schools that we personally visited, you know. For example, in Tabodona in Gaudeng, is a school that has a massive overcrowding issue that I think the department would need to just go and do a visit and look at as part of their trip. Golden Step in KZN in Verulam was completely vandalized and looted. And it's a special school, and the only special school in that particular area that actually houses learners. And I think that needs to be looked at to check whether it's actually ready. Sikululwe in KZN has been burned down, literally half the block, the main admin block. So we need to look at schools like that, whether they're actually ready to be reopened. I've just mentioned Zwelitsha in the Eastern Cape, which has a massive overcrowding issue. In fact, that school is still a mud school, and it was promised to be built upon your visit, DG and Minister, 4 years ago. So maybe that's something that needs to be looked at. Ititabane is the only non-fee paying school in Yugi, still dilapidated and asbestos. When we went there, the Department of Education in the Eastern Cape said they would do renovations. I was recently there, nothing has been done there. And this school has a massive overcrowding issue because it's dilapidated. More so than anything, it's the only non-fee paying school with close to 2,000 learners that are dependent on that school. You've got schools like Madikitsha Primary School in Limpopo that was, the fence was completely gone. So we need to look at schools like that to check that the safety mechanisms that need to be put in place are there. Owar Mabawacha, with completely no access to water as the first line of defense to COVID. Sundra in the Mpumalanga also does not have fencing, as well as Raid Call in Mpumalanga does not have fencing at all. In fact, that school is cited as consistently being targeted and vandalized and stolen into. Sundra is not even maintained. It's poorly maintained. It's a former war school, as you can see it. As when you visit, you can see it, but it's actually poorly maintained. And lastly, you've got Masinagana Special School, which the department had communicated with me to ask where that school is based, which is a special school in Mpumalanga that has converted hostels, classrooms into hostels. That denies the full reopening of that school because 187 learners have denied access to that. So these are some of the schools I'm just citing out of the top of my mind based on my visits that we need to look at to ensure that the necessary mechanisms are put in place by the departments in those provinces to give the necessary support. Then my last question, Chair, is on scholar transport. In KZN, there were 120,000 learners that were eligible for scholar transport from the last response from the minister. I see this number has now significantly increased. Is there a reason why the number has increased in terms of how many learners that are eligible that can't be transported? And that there's a decrease in terms of supply. I see there's 60,000 learners that have been catered for scholar transport in KZN. Is there a reason for the increase in number of learners now that are now eligible for transport but can't get transport? And why is there only budgeted for 60,000 learners? And what happens to the rest that are supposed to be transported? Thanks, Chair. I think that was long, but I think these questions are critical for us to get the full reports for, and some answers that can't be answered, can they please be given as a written response within the 7-day period that we normally request for the portfolio committee? Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Itbia.
Thank you very much, Chair. I would request that I do not put my video on. I kept losing Honorable Nodada, so it means my bandwidth is not really strong. But good morning to everybody, members and the guests on the platform, the minister and the team led by the DG from the department. I think some of the questions, I was just scratching them out here when Honorable Nodada was speaking, which I believe I would have raised. But in the interest of time, I think I'll just go to the few that are left, and I hope it did not touch, as I would have been having some smaller than a problems with network. One, on the judgment, one of the slides spoke about the judgment that was meted out on the right to education. And the department on the slide suggests that there are other district schools, and to a certain extent, maybe a province or so, that are disregarding that judgment. And the reason is that they think it only applies to one province and not the rest. Or start something like that. And I think when I try to look at what is it that the department is doing to respond to that, and I think the response from the department minister is quite lenient. And I would like to employ it on yourselves to be hard when we deal with this, with such things. I mean, this is exactly why in this country the people lost their lives to fight for such basic things. And when we deal with them, we can't deal with them with kids' gloves. So we must be clear, we must send out circulars. We must be clear that this is what the judgment says, this is what the department says. And as long as you are part of this country, you will not do anything outside of what we are saying should be done as guided by the judgment of the courts. Unless people want to disrespect the courts, but they must not disrespect the court and the department, but also don't disrespect the laws of this country. So I think on consequence management, as far as those schools are concerned, we ought to be very strict, Minister. We ought to put our feet down and make sure that our schools do obey such judgment from the courts. But also they listen, they obey what the department says. So we must not be too soft on that. Two, on slide 22 of the presentation, we have over 580,000 of learners that have not been placed yet, as things stand. That's well over 500,000 of learners from grade R to grade 12 in the country have not been placed. So I can just imagine where they are now, their parents and all of that. What is it that, they're going through? It's a stressful period. For them, some of them, if they're probably going to do grade 12 or grade 11, they've been writing examinations, very stressed, not knowing whether they are going or coming. And that might negatively affect some of their performances in this current examination. Which brings me, Minister, to... Obviously, that most of them are coming from Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, and the Western Cape, which is the big sort of provinces where people migrate to, which is almost understandable. But I still think those three provinces, in terms of infrastructure, we should be able to be able to respond to some of these things. Majority of them, actually, they obviously did not get a breakdown, but I can guess that majority of them are in the big metros of eThekwini, the big metro of Cape Town, then the big metros of Ekurhuleni and Johannesburg and Tshwane. So we should not really be struggling with the infrastructure. In this case, the IT infrastructure, you know, make sure that we're able to respond to these challenges, which Minister brings me to the point of SA funds. In my view, SA funds should be able to assist us in responding to some of these challenges we're getting. SA funds, you know, is an IT system that we use in, I forgot the number, I think it was 98.6% or something like that, as presented by the department on one of the slides, that has been used by those many schools. It's almost all the schools in this country. And one of the things that they do, obviously, is to place learners, is to deal with this issue of timetables, placed teachers in a particular school and stuff like that. But if SA SAMS can respond to this thing, and Minister, I want to be a little bit political with you on this one. You will forgive me, Minister. You know, so if we are to respond to some of this challenges that SA SAMS bring, or some of the systems bring, but SA SAMS can respond to, will it not really, Minister, be advisable for us, for the department, to look at other ways of enhancing or assisting SA SAMS in responding to some of the challenges here. So what I'm asking is, can't we really look at creative ways of bringing innovative, exciting, useful ideas to assist us with these challenges that we're facing now? Because if you have 2 months before schools open, a few weeks before schools closes for a particular, for this particular year, and maybe 2 months before they open. And I'm saying 2 months, I'm not sure, as Honorable Nada asked that this presentation falls short of informing us when schools will reopen next year. But with such tight schedules, we still have over 500,000 of our learners not placed. And that the number can even be more, because I think it was Limpopo on the slide that was shared with us, where we did not have any numbers for Limpopo, you know, on that slide. So the number might be high. So will it not assist, Minister, that we play an active role as a department in creating a platform for exciting new ideas in the IT space, bringing SMMEs or inviting SMMEs to present to the department, you know, with solicited, kind of solicited proposals to respond specifically to the issue of placement of learners. Let's hear these exciting ideas that might be out there idling in the streets of South Africa from many graduates who, some of them might have actually graduated in ICT, but you know, let's create an enabling environment for this exciting young people to come to the fore and assist us in addressing some of these issues. Maybe keep NSA sums for other issues. That was just what I wanted, this one for you, Minister. But two, the department, all of these numbers that are not yet placed, what is it that you have done? What are the mitigating factors, the real mitigating factors that you have put in place to avoid that next year, this time, we'll also have 580,000 learners will not be placed at the end of November for the following year or more. What is it that you are doing there? And so that we don't sit year in and year out, discuss the numbers instead of discussing solutions for the following years. Now, obviously, probably we can't do anything about it now, but I'm saying next year, it will be our fault that if we sit here next year and we still have the same problems. So what is it that you have done or you are doing to make sure that these matters do not happen next year? Of course, I understand that some of them apply late and all of those things, but what is it that the mitigating factors, because we know what are the root causes, migration, late applications, and all of those, but what are the mitigating factors having identified the root causes? slide 27. Amongst other slides, by the way, speaks to the info there that was compiled on the 25th of October 2021. And today is the 30th of November. So some 1 month and 6 days, some good 5 weeks period in between the information there that the department compiles. It's not the only one, there are others. I'm just making an example with this one. Why haven't we updated the status to maybe at least last week's information so that when we sit there, we interact with up-to-date information? I heard the presenter there said some of them said November, some of their targets were November, but they were already done. You know, it does not give us the comfort to say, for example, three districts in Gauteng would have put November as a target. But maybe even though you may not mention the district, say 60% of the schools in Gauteng, for an example, have already reached their target. So it gives us an indication that we are moving in the right direction. But the information as compiled in the slides, does not give me the comfort where I'm sitting. And therefore, I was just suggest next time maybe let's update information before we share it here with the public, because really 25 October, it's a long time ago, and people out there who are our guests who are here and out there at home might not really think, they might think was lacking there in the department, which I don't think is the case. But we don't want to create that perception for them to do that. But the information in that slide is about the vacancies or undeclared vacancies. And I heard the presenter while saying those who are graduates from public universities, Funza Lushaka, NSFAS, and all of that will be looked at and placed. But a few weeks ago, We had received an email from PGCE graduates who sent us emails. I'm not sure if it was sent to me alone, but I saw there were many were tagged there, who complained that especially the Department of Education in the Free State has decided not to appoint PGCE teachers in that province, whereas there's not been any formal communication that the PGCE graduates are no longer suitable to teach. So maybe take this opportunity, department, and clarify us here. Because one of the things that they are asking is, has SAQA and DHET decided to render this particular qualification dysfunctional? And why is it still, this qualification still offered in educational institutions if it is indeed declared dysfunctional? And why, you know, they ask a lot of questions. Why is SAQA still continuing to issue a PGCE graduate with permanent certificates and all of these things, whereas they are not placed? And I'm willing to even forward the email to yourselves there in the department so that you can also liaise with them, because they make a lot of too many allegations that they are not responded anywhere, and hence that is why they've decided to write to some of us in the portfolio committee. So maybe those would have been the few things. I think not that they would have covered me in many of the points that I wanted to make. But Minister, thank you very much. I hope you indulge me on my political points that I made about growing, taking advantage of, you know, the intellectual capacity you might have here, sitting at home, roaming the streets on this thing of ICT. Thank you very much.
Honorable Dr. Tembekwaya, I see the end of Honorable Van der Walt is no longer there.
Is it my turn now?
Yes, I think you must proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson.
I'm still here.
I just want to say thank you very much for the... Hello. Yes, Jay, I'm still here. Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. I see your hand is just vanished. Okay, it's fine.
Because you noted me, I've taken it down. Yeah, Chair, thank you for the presentation as well as lots of info, and some of our colleagues have addressed issues like the quintiles that I think should come up for revised has been mentioned. I just want to raise a few things, and I want to start off by something that I saw this week. And it might be very related to Limpopo only, but as we travel around the country on highways, we often see mobile classrooms being delivered, for which we are always, or being transported, for which we are always thankful. But something odd I saw yesterday was loads and loads of learner desks on trucks. And it immediately put a question mark, because we are in COVID for some time now, and it seems like we'll be in that sort of pandemic situation for another long time to come. And I was wondering, why on earth would any department order double seaters if we still have to put something in between learners? Why aren't we going for single seaters to keep our learners safe in classrooms? So I also really think we should question on how different provinces order their furniture for schools in this pandemic situation. Chairperson, I would also like to, when we talk about safety of schools, I mean, there is the property, there are the safety of our learners, safe transport. There are also learners whose parents can't afford learner transport sometimes privately, and some of them doesn't stay within the prescribed kilometers away from school, and often we find that learners are walking to school in very unsafe and difficult routes. One of those situations is that we have found learners in two villages in Limpopo, all from the area of Wondu and Fapidi in Tulamela, that has to cross the Mchundudi River with a man-made sort of a bridge. And we all know it's raining season, and during the last month we have seen really serious rains. And I would wonder if the department can make a note to find out what is happening with learners walking from Bondu and Fapidi villages in Toyando, because it's definitely, we went to look at it, and it's really putting the life of learners at the risk in those two areas. Chairperson, another issue on safety is the safety and the sexual misconduct that we saw SAFE presented in a report at the previous meeting. And I would like to ask the registers, the National Register for Sex Offenders, as well as the Child Protection Register, whether the department, as soon and through SAFE, I suppose, and I know Social Development Department is sort of involved or runs the register, what is the role of the Department of Basic Education once a teacher or a staffer is found guilty of misconduct and their names are submitted to the register? Are we actually making sure or get some report that this is being done, whether these names are recorded, and how long does it take? Because we have found over many, many years that these registers always have issues. And then I would also like to know whether these registers are available to the public, or if not, will it be made available to the portfolio committee where teachers are listed in these registers? Chairperson, and I really want to raise it here. I have written to the SAPS minister in August and advocating for the inclusion of the following in the quarterly and annually crime statistics report. And I was wondering whether the minister of DBE would also petition her colleague, the Minister of SAPS, to assist. I think we need a breakdown of sexual offences or abuse of learners on school property, also when they are on school activities away, like sports or music or wherever they are within the school activity line. We need to know what the underage pregnancies are, and we need to know whether the current open dockets of statutory rape and statutory rape cases that have led to convictions. We can't have learners that are about 700 or so or of 10 years of age being pregnant and have to give birth. That is statutory rape. Now, I need to know where that is recorded in the police crime statistics. And I think we as DBE need these stats separately. We need to know in every province what's happening, and we need it verified, and we need it made public. Chairperson, another thing that is really of concern to me is therapists at schools. And I'm specifically referring to the special needs schools across our country, specifically where there are hostels learners living in hostels as well. We just see that too many schools for our blind learners and learners with other challenges doesn't have any therapist. We don't have nurses, we don't have occupational therapists, we don't have social workers. We really are neglecting. We don't have psychologists. And I wonder sometimes if we really care for these learners. And I have been advocating over years now in the department, in portfolio committees, that we have to put up a request to the Minister of Health to use the students who study in these disciplines to actually come and do their ComServe years in these schools across the country. I have really on the record every single year is that medical students are not placed. Now, there might be other issues in the health department, budgets. I know our minister says, where's the budgets going to come from? But for the sake of the learners in these schools, we have to put up a fight. We cannot let people who study medical disciplines not being placed because one department can't place them. There's a major, major need in our special needs schools. And if those students can't be placed by the Department of Health, they should, with a budget, then come to basic education. They are much, much needed. We really, really have to put up a fight for this. I think we can do it if we really want to do it. Chairperson, I also, I would like to know in the school readiness, we started off with the mother tongue learning. We started in the Eastern Cape. And I would like to know if we are ready for 2022 to expand on this. And if so, if we can just have a very brief response on where. I was also very concerned about slide 22, where the Limpopo province, I know it was mentioned, still that it has got zero response. I mean, what happens to provinces if they don't respond on this placed and unplaced learners? Surely our minister as the custodian and our DG must have some influence to get these provinces, especially Limpopo, who we know is not performing well year after year. But, you know, if you can't get the basics right in your reporting system, I don't know how you will get education right. Chairperson, I will hold for there and submit the others in written question. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Dr. Maguire.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, DBE, for the presentation. Most of my questions are already exhausted, but I'll just ask a few that are remaining. And the first one is based on the COVID-19 and its unending waves. Right now, there's a talk of fourth wave. But my question is, how ready is your department schools in connection with the continuation of adherence to the COVID-19 protocol? How ready are they at this point? Will they be able to continue if this fourth now becomes 20th wave of COVID-19? The second question is based, even though it's a repetition of what has been said, in connection with the learner transport. Learner transport has been a major problem and is continuing to be. How will you resolve the problems of the learner transport, including the one that is mentioned in one of those slides of the KZN, specifically the special education needs 75 schools that needs transport? How do you plan to intervene in connection with the network connectivity experienced by certain schools? Because COVID-19 era demands that online classes should be a continuity. So if the network connectivity is a problem, then it obviously means the online classes will not take place. So how would your intervention in this regard be? The unplaced 108,494 grade R learners specifically in Gauteng needs to be attended to. Is there any specific intervention plan from your department in this regard? And lastly, it's a continuation of the problem that I reported 2 weeks ago about the Botshabelo Primary School principal. The primary school is in Mamelodi. And then, as I mentioned, it's about the treatment that is received by the education assistants there to say they are made to clean, even do gardening and all sorts of things, including the screeners that are hired at that school. But the reason why I'm doing a follow-up is because today I got some photos of the very same young EAs doing gardening at the school. That is not acceptable, and it can't be. Even though I heard that a certain district official, Mr. Sukumoto, went there, and I've got the video there of, he didn't go there to solve the problem, but he went there just to display some sense of arrogance to those poor education assistants. Please, can the department intervene? I have already sent the photos of what happened this morning, them being asked to clean and doing the gardening and so on. This is the Department of Education, and these are the education assistants. They cannot clean, Minister. Please, we need your intervention in this regard, please. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, good day, and good day to all members on this all-important platform, Portfolio Committee on Basic Education. Chairperson, allow me to join the other colleagues in welcoming and appreciating what to me is seen to be a well-oiled presentation from DBE, of course, under the stewardship of the Honorable and the Minister of Basic Education, Mama Enchi, and administratively under the DG, the Dimwele. The Department of Education has made a presentation. It is correctly said that a journey of 1 million miles it begins with one step. It is good that this portfolio committee is appraised, especially on the school readiness for the academic year 2022. And the report itself poses very clearly that and even the minister highlighted that 2021, when we all thought it would be a better year, it has been one of those difficult years, like the trauma we had to go through during 2020. The report, I might not be able to quote exactly the slide, shows and displays the number of districts in the different provinces which will have been targeted to be visited. It's a good plan. We appreciate, we welcome, we commend the department for that. However, I'm raising question, Chairperson. The question which will say, which criteria was used in selecting those districts? And I'm saying so because, Chairperson, at the end of the visit, we must be able to attach Velu. At that time, we visited the following districts because of the following reasons. And we were able to achieve the reasons why the schools over the districts were visited. So that you see, it should not just be seen as a nominal and a routine work. Visiting for the sake of visiting. Let us plan to visit where visitation is necessary, so that at the end of the day, we are able to arrive at the intended goal. Number two, maybe related to number one, is the issue of stocktaking. You see, Murula Studio, year in and year out, we have got this visits, school readiness visits, for purposes of seeing if our schools are ready for the education and learning as expected. So I think sometimes we must pause, reflect, and think. And that we visited the following areas. The following were the problems identified. And in a moment like this, when we prepared for the other visit, we have got a summary of stock taking to reflect that. Indeed, amongst the challenges that we met in our previous visits were the following. And the following were able to be addressed. That kind of reporting is going to assist all the teams that will be visiting the school, because visits keep on coming year in and year out, and they must be able to bring fruit at the end of the day. And that can only happen if the department is able to expose on the failures and the successes in their stock-taking report, to give that kind of report based on our previous visitations. And then number three, it's the issue which was covered, of course, by Honorable Lithia and also Ubaba Nodada. The issue on, of course, I think Dr. Tembakwayo also touched it, the vaccination issue. The pandemic has done us a heavy blow. We have lost a number of educators, a high number of educators, others dying even at the marking centers because of this pandemic, COVID-19, global pandemic. So there is now the challenge of vaccination. Honorable Nodada wanted to know the number of those who might have been vaccinated and those vis-a-vis those who might who are still to be vaccinated. I know it may not be a possible question for the department to respond, but at least if we were to say the percentage wise, how many educators as we speak might have been vaccinated and how many not yet? And the same with learners. We know it is long that learners and 15 years and above, it has been open to them. You see, because this is going to assist us. It will assist us to make it a point that we propagate the whole principle of safety for those people and educators who might have been. Because those educators not vaccinated remain a threat to those who have been vaccinated. While there is this debate, Honorable Minister, of whether it should be made mandatory or not mandatory. But I think a recommendation from your department will assist the president with his task team when they will be reporting or coming to the logical conclusion whether indeed at the end of the day we should declare this a mandatory undertaking or not. Because what is the use of putting me, saying I've been vaccinated, into a pool of more than 100 educators or more than 50 educators who are unvaccinated, prone to the infection of the pandemic. We are risking each other because Maina, where I'm standing, I maintain that those who are not vaccinated are posing and they are like a hazardous to the group of those who have been vaccinated. That is where I stand. Other people might subscribe to a different view, but this is my position and this is my view, and this is because this is my life. So what is the position of the department in as far as that this is concerned? Because the department also has got its own policies it is operating on. Though those policies at the end of the day must be found, of course, within the umbrella or a policy of the land. The last question, Chairperson, is with regard to the admission. We are talking here about readiness, school readiness, especially for 2022. But even before I sum up on this last question, let me indicate that sometimes, you see, it becomes questionable, when are we to test the school readiness? Are we supposed to test it the beginning of the year or towards the end of the year? You be the judge. But can the department try and reflect on that? Because Mina, I would say the purpose of school readiness visits in principle should be saying, we want to say, we visit in order to check the school readiness this year, so that come 2022, we have got a super start. So if we are still going to make the school readiness visit at the beginning of the year, when the schools are supposed to start, how are we going to come up with remedial measures? You be the judge. I'm just posting these things because to me, I take it we must be able to address the problem, to identify the problem for purposes of addressing it while there's no time. The last question with regard to this, it's with regard to the Mudulasitulo on admission of children of foreign nationals vis-a-vis the ongoing challenge of placing our own children. You see, I know the department lost the case on this matter, but if this statement of mine is not well qualified, the minister is in this meeting, she will correctly put it in the correct perspective. But what I learned is that there was a case on the admission of children of foreign nationals, and now the judgment says all these kids must be admitted. And whether documented or not documented, they must just be admitted. But the minister will speak very clearly on this, the director general. We'll talk straight with it. Now, I wanted the department with regard to this. Admission of children of foreign nationals vis-a-vis the ongoing challenge of placing our own kids. I wanted the department, can the department just say something around this? Which is what? And what is being given the first priority? You see, if the department can just say something, it will assist us because it's true. My predecessors made mention of the frustration wherein there are still those kids of the South African foreigners who are still on the waiting list as we are speaking now. Now, as if that is not enough, it is being compounded and is going to be compounded by the mass and the unselective admission. You see, we must respect the rules, the rule of law of the country. But yes, we respect it, while at the same time we address what is particular. What is going to be the use at the end of the day if our own kids will not be admitted, whilst there is this the ruling which says we have to admit all and sundry, whether documented or not? I'm not challenging the court ruling. I'm saying, how do we get all our kids admitted without keeping on putting them on the waiting list? I'm saying this, the minister knows it very well, and this portfolio committee knows it very well, that I am a victim of this kind of situation, where the child had to wait until March to be admitted. I think something must be done, Honorable Minister. I don't know what is it, but you and I can join hands and come with a workable solution. Thank you.
Are you done now, Principal?
Yeah, no, that's why Philip Jacob, thank you. I wanted to say as I paralyzed you, maybe because
No, because you kept on saying last question, so I
No, that was the last question right there. I'm very sorry.
All right. No, that's fine. I think it's just safe for us to thank the department for this presentation. It's very informative. And it's actually tells us that the department is very ready for 2022, despite the few challenges that of course mentioned in the presentation, which it's challenges that will always be there. But the point that I want to raise from my side is the issue of this ECD migration, which we're expecting to see it commencing in April next year. And I understand that you don't necessarily have to report on it because you are reporting on the readiness of January. But the reality is something new and something that is going to happen next year. And you are working on it. Officials are working on it. And it has to happen next year. So one would have hoped that at least it's something that you would be able to brief us on as well. Even if it's just a small briefing on it. Because I think all of us, we need to make sure that this transition is going to be a smooth transition that will be able to happen very smooth. And then there is a slide on the presentation where you are reflecting on the placed and unplaced learners, but Limpopo province, there is no reflection there of the placed and unplaced learners. There are no figures when it comes to Limpopo. Can we be briefed or why, or maybe you didn't get the stats from Limpopo? And then there is also a slide that speaks on textbook retrieval, where it says the range in all other provinces is between 90% to 97%, except for the Eastern Cape, where it's 71%. What could be the reason? Is it dropout associated reasons, or is it just learners are deciding not to bring back the textbooks? We went to an oversight January or February this year, where we went to KZN and Eastern Cape. And what was common in the schools that we went for a visit in the Eastern Cape was that textbooks were, okay, not textbook rather, but all the learning material was not delivered. Actually, in the school where we were getting in, we would be told that no, the truck is coming, they are coming to deliver. And the schools were already open at that time. Now, where I'm getting into, the department, can it assure us that there will be 100% LTSM delivery for 2022 when the schools are opening? Actually, not necessarily when the schools are opening, but when January commences. Because last year it was not the case, especially in the province of the Eastern Cape. And then there is a continuous problem of late applications. I think even now I'm still even in my office getting letters of learners that are not accepted, that would want to change the schools, that their parents are moving and they still want schools. It's continuous, it's there every day because of the movement of parents in our country. But how do we inform our people, you know, of these applications? Except for that is known. I know there are still parents who don't know actually that you need to apply for your child, and after a particular month, the applications are not gonna be entertained by the department and so on. But the reality is there is still a movement of schools, and there are schools, I mean, of people. And there are schools in this country of ours where they would not even entertain the fact that learners would move. I'm not saying that those restrictions should not be entertained, but the point I'm trying to raise is that can't our schools at least have a leeway of accepting learners where conditions really allow that, they don't allow that a parent would leave their children. I'm sure even yourselves, where you are, it's a problem that you don't know how to deal with it. Especially your previous, your former white schools, it's very difficult for them to accept such learners. They do not want to accept those learners. And in many schools, even if there is hope, but they would remain on a waiting list forever and not necessarily being accepted, which actually deals with many families in our society. I thought from my side, let me raise those issues. And in the absence of hands from many from members, we are now at 12:12. I am going to allow the minister to lead the responses, and then so will be the DG and Ms. Gaya. Thank you very much, Minister.
No, thank you very much, Chair, and thanks again for the opportunity to present the report to the committee, and also thank you very much for the engagement. Chair, I won't take all the questions. I'll just maybe answer a few questions, and then colleagues from the department or officials from the department will take other questions. I think on infrastructure, it will be quite easy and possible to send you a full infrastructure report even within the 7 days, because we do meet weekly to take reports from our own monitoring, but also from provinces. Because indeed we meet bi-weekly, we visit schools. DG has been spending most of his time in provinces. DM is in provinces, also visiting schools, and I was in Soweto schools yesterday. So we will be able to give you a full report so that I shouldn't really take time to answer question by question, but we're able to give a full report just about infrastructure, even for areas where you have not asked us, we should be able to give you that report. So I'll answer the general questions, Chair, just to give a context when officials respond. You know, Chair, I always wish to always humbly remind people that education is a concurrent function. And it has its strengths, it has its weaknesses. Its strengths is that there are huge capacities which are located in provinces where the bulk of the implementation happen. So I always remind people to say, you know, when I was MEC, I had 10 times or 12 times the capacity of national, because that's where the implementation happened. I had the national office, the head office, which was bigger than the whole national office. I had 21 districts, which had more than 200 people in them. So it shows you that the bulk of the implementations in provinces, and what we do as national strategically, it's to monitor and support provinces, because one member says minister have to be strong in other things, which I really sometimes wish we could. But the advantage is that we actually have a very good relationship with the provinces, which is very professional. But what I can do when MECs don't do work, premiers appoint MECs and heads of department. If I'm to assume any power that is an MEC's power, then I need to go to the NCOP and cabinet, like we have done in Northwest. So there are certain things, Chair, which we are not able to do, but and I'm quite comfortable with that. We work professionally with colleagues, we nudge them. So the reports we're giving you is reports that we get from MECs or provinces. It's not that we're not owning them, but I just thought I should raise this, in relation to the issue of what are the limitations of what I can do when things don't happen elsewhere. We have powers to do other things. I am able to make policies. For instance, when there was this court decision, in terms of powers vested in me as policy, I'm able to say to all provinces, you shall do the following in terms of policy and regulations. So I thought I should clarify that, Chair, and maybe, yeah. And then on SAMS, and I also agree because I'm responding to this one because the colleague said it's a political one. He wants to throw the political ball at me. So I thought, let me not run from it. You see, SA SAMS, and we very much want to get as many young people as possible with ICT skills in the sector, because ICT is the future. And that's why when we got, for instance, post that for young people that we bring in schools, we have a whole cohort of what we call ICT cadres, because we are aware that we're going to need lots and lots of creativity and skills to get this ICT program going. So we're really working consciously and deliberately to get them in. But the comment came in the context of SASMs. SA, without being defensive, Chair, SASMs, it's a legal platform, which you can't even ourselves do as you wish on it, because it has private information of people, of children and their families. So it's regulated by law. And that's why we do it through your state information agencies, because it has to be vetted, information has to be protected. So it's not anything that you handle the way you wish to and say you can invite people to get there. People who will come there will have come through your CETA, they have to be vetted, there are all legal processes in place to protect the information that will be contained in SASMs. There's other information which the platform will open up, like your curriculum and other things for people to access. But the whole process, it's very legally managed to protect, as I say, in particular, the information. So even ourselves working on it, we have to work with CETA. We can't work on it on our own. But I'm saying there is always opportunity to work with young people on ICTs. But as I say, there are those limitations also around the CETA and how you handle CETA information. The other point I thought I should also respond to, Chair. Yeah, so I did make an example about what are the powers that we have, what are the limitations. DG will answer. I don't know about PGC being no longer a relevant qualification. And I think also the information about that member raised around SAIS and how we deal with teachers who are offenders and how we publish that information. But what I want to also say, Chair, we debate this all the time about COVID-19. Our assumption, and maybe I hope we're correct, that it's a temporal problem. So we can't have permanent solutions for a temporal problem. People have been encouraging us to roll a number of classrooms so that we don't have migration, other things. And the thing is that if we do, and by 2023, 2024, there's no longer, what do we do with that infrastructure which we would have put in place if indeed we're able to for a temporal problem? So our sense is that COVID is a temporal problem. We have to find ways of trying to bring a return to normality, like vaccinating young people, reducing more space. I mean, we're allowed to reduce from 1.5 to 1. We're pushing to be allowed to really reduce to 500 millimeters and health refused. But our assumption or our attitude is that we will not have permanent solutions to this temporal problem. So your two sitting desks are just part of a permanent way of dealing with spaces in our classrooms, so that you don't have all these loose desks. And there are reasons also, even in terms of these two-seater desks. You know, if you go to any market, you will find our single desks are there as tables to sell and other things, even for security reasons, for furniture. These two desks, people don't want them. They don't remove them from our classrooms. But these single desks are a huge risk. We lose them quite quick. And so there are also other considerations why we will still continue to want that. There was also an issue about safety, which is our biggest concern, Chair. I can't remember the number of areas that I gave to Cabinet to say I need, because building up roads, it's not an education competency, but remember, it's right, it's in our interest to get those footbridges built, but it's not, it's roads, it's public works, it's everybody. So we gave Cabinet a number of areas where there is a definite need for working, about 163 areas throughout the country. So it's not only in Limpopo. If you go to KZN, kids will be crossing very dangerous rivers, Mpumalanga, Eastern Cape. So it's given them a list of bridges where we've asked Public Works to help us to build bridges to link schools even across mountains, because kids will go into mountainous areas. As soon as they go in, they get violated, they get attacked. And so we've identified those areas. And again, I'm hoping that government broadly will be able to help us. But on our own, it's not anything that we can do. And also the matter of Member van der Walt wanted us to say how many children. We don't collect statistics on teenage pregnancy as the department. It's statistics that we get from health and other people. Because when a child disappears, you're not sure whether they've moved away with their father, whether you can assume that if your child doesn't turn up and come into school, they're pregnant. And they will not even sometimes report pregnancies. So we know only of pregnancies which are in our space. Hey, Chair, I forgot to close my phone, I'm sorry. Yeah. So we only know of learners that have come and we can give them, but that won't be your proper statistics. And there, as I said, there are limitations about how we can report on that. But there are also in terms of, I mean, from the reverse said we have to fight blood for rights, and which we do. Our teachers sometimes risk themselves a lot, even fighting with colleagues when children are violated. But there are also laws which regulate how we deal with a situation of, for instance, which we are aware of your statutory rape. We are bound by law to report in incidents when we are aware. And after reporting, it's no longer our matter. It falls to the police. So you also don't want to encroach into areas which legally are not yours and really get measured up with legal process, because the ones have to, the police know how to deal with the different crimes and they have to manage it. So teachers can't deal with criminal matters. They can report, and that's where it ends, because the relevant authorities have to take place. And I really, Chair, without taking too much of your time, want to also comment on the employment of doctors. I thought member was already saying from the heart that we have to place and place doctors. I mean, how do we do it? And I think the insinuation that because we don't place and place doctors as the Department of Education, we don't care about blind learners. I think it's very unfortunate, Chair, because it suggests that we don't care and member cares more than everybody. And I really want to say with humility, we all care about learners with special needs. We care about all our learners in the sector. If we fail to do something, it's not lack of care. For instance, in that sector, we employ on the basis of need. So we don't place doctors at the Department of Health. So if we need a doctor in the system, we have the budget for it, we have a post for it, we'll advertise and the doctor will apply. And that's how the law regulates us to function. On COVID-19, Chair, I have no doubt that our schools are COVID ready. We visit schools regularly. Schools are still going on even under the COVID-19, so they've not closed. So we will proceed as we are continuing now, and only if there are other changes, we'll have to adapt to changes. But I was in Orlando yesterday visiting schools, and the protocols were in place. Grade 12s were there in their big numbers. They were writing English, but other classes were writing. And I observed the protocols that were happening. So I assume that we'll be able to do that. On Member Tembekwayo's point, we will follow up with the issue. And I don't want to prejudge the situation to say those that were sweeping are teacher assistants, because we have three categories of people in our schools. We have your general workers, which are doing the gardens, which are painting in schools, which are cleaning and doing all sorts of things, because they're not teacher assistants. Teacher assistants are those preferably who have matric plus, who have some teaching skills, who are helping teachers with reading, with classwork. So it's not everybody that we have put on this program who is a teacher assistant. Some people we took without matric. Some people we took without perhaps even the skills that we require in the schools to be able to assist us with other work that we do, including cleaning up the, we wanted beautifying our schools. We had said by the end of this program, where possible, we want all broken doors fixed, all broken windows fixed. That's why we took also general workers who've got skills to do other work. So if they're doing gardens, my preference would have been if there was a broken window, they paint ceilings, we want them to paint, school roofs. Not all of them are teacher assistants. So I would want to know those that were made to sweep, are they the young people? Because we have people with degrees who are in this program, and then that you get a person who's an unplaced teacher being made to sweep, whereas they could be used. We have people with science in those schools who've got BSc degrees, and I'm sure those people were placed to assist schools, high schools with where the science and other things, but remember, they've not been employed in the same way. And that's why I would want to check if they are getting teacher assistants to sweep, or are they the general workers that are made to sweep. Yeah, and then this thing about foreign learners, again, I want to be very careful about it because it can be sensitive. And if I'm mistaken, please, I apologize in advance. You know, as South Africa, we are signatories to some international laws. And that's why we lose the court cases against foreign learners, because we can't have different laws as education against the international laws that we have. Because international laws say every child has the right to education, wherever they are. So if they are undocumented, if they're foreign learners, it's a problem of the parents, not of the learners. And therefore, we are bound to keep these kids in school. It's just part of international law, which we are signatory to. And sometimes, Chair, and that's where I apologize, I think sometimes we might exaggerate, and that's my view, what is not a big problem. You see, we have more than 13 million South African learners in schools. And I doubt if we have more than a million learners in our schools, right? So we have allowed foreigners to come into their country. They are young, they are human beings. They, by nature, have children. So I don't know whether we would expect that they should keep their children at home whilst they're working for us, because we know that they're here. We see them. Some of us even employ them, we use them. They do all sorts of things. So when their children are here, we are bound by law, our law and international law, to allow them to go into school. So I just thought I should do that. And the last point, Chair, that I want to respond to, which you raised around ECD. I think we'll be happy again to give an update of ECD, but I can assure you what is going to happen in April, this won't be dramatic. Because what we've been working on with social development is actually a technical legal transfer, because we couldn't take the responsibility until the legal processes have been done. So what I expect from next year, it's really just sorting out the legal parts, as we had reported to you, but not that by next year, the whole stock will be with us, will be running with ECD. It's a phased process, and I don't see us even finishing that process in less than 3 to 5 years. So it's a long road that the sector is going to be facing, but we can give you the report just to really assure people. And the opening of schools, there was a question about opening of schools. This year we've decided to phase in differently, and DG will correct me, that your inland schools are opening in January, your coastal schools are opening in January the 12th for inland, coastal is 19. But unless anything dramatic happens, these are the dates that we're working around. If the current virus or the infections and don't subside between December and early January, we'll play it by ear, but that's the date and that's what we're working on. And the last one, Chair, about delivery of books and other things. Again, I don't want to give to be seen to be apologizing for provinces. You know, when schools open, we have lots of difficulties. We normally give schools, not all of them, some stable schools have already given their kids books in December, they had collected. But in some instances, books cannot be delivered because there are no storerooms, there's also risk of vandalism. So we give them between 10 days and even up to a month to distribute books. Sometimes it's even for safety, especially in the coastal areas. There's lots of movement between province to province and intra-provincially. Children live with books. You think you have distributed books. The next time those 10 children are not here, maybe they're going to independent schools. So they normally play and wait until they have stabilized. And when they feel stable that the kids who are there permanently, then they distribute books. So on day one, we want as much as possible that they should be teaching. But different schools will explain, or even provinces will say, this school, we don't give them books day one because these kids come and collect books, and then they go to independent schools. Others across the province, we give them books, they go back to Zim with their books, or Mozambique. So there are different provinces and different schools which would not distribute books on day one. But I'm not saying in that case of the Eastern Cape and KZN, it will have been the case of the movement in the first 10 days. But we normally give them 10 to 30 days to settle down and make sure that within 10 days, we normally have the first, within 10 days, books have been distributed, but not necessarily on day one. So, Chair, I'm sorry to have taken long, and we'll ask DG and colleagues to also respond to other questions.
No, thanks, ma. I thought DG would just proceed. DG?
Nkosi Shalo, Nkosi Mphathiswa, honorable members. I had requested that Ms. Geya must help me to lead because I'm working in the villages of Kumbu and Tata. And network connectivity is a rare commodity in these areas. In case I get cut off the network, Ms. Geya will continue. I just want to touch a few points. The minister has been very comprehensive in responding to a number of questions. Let me just contribute by saying that from 2020 to 2021, our enrollment figures increased from 13.1 million to 13.4 million. And I've asked our EMIS officials more than three times to confirm that. And it was confirmed because it seems to refute the large numbers that people were saying learners got lost from COVID-19. which means we had an increase of 300,000 more learners into the system, which is the highest ever in the history of education. So it will answer issues of dropout rate. It will also answer issues of increase in the demand for learner transport. That figure is attributable to all those things. The second point has to do with psychosocial services that we provide. Indeed, we don't have that per school, but we're providing them at district level and at provincial level. The LSITD grant chair that the portfolio committee used to wrap us around the knuckle about virtually every appearance when we report on our expenditure. What was the reason for under expenditure was the delay in the appointment of the social workers, appointment of the psychologists, which provinces have succeeded in doing. That is not enough for the entire system, but it cannot be correct to say we don't have any of those services. Those services are there. They are provided for, they are called the multidisciplinary team at district and provincial level. I also want to, in fact, the minister responded to the issue of the teacher assistants and general workers, and I think that has been well covered. Then the issue of admission. We used to be worried about admission in Gauteng and Western Cape in particular. Over the past 2 to 3 years, we are no longer worried. In fact, the figures that appear now, we've got to record them as such. There would be instances where parents would have applied to more than one school, and they are just waiting for a response from a school of their choice. And it used to take up to even April, May, for Gauteng, Western Cape, and Honorable Murateka is right. Even his child had to wait, I think, until April, May. We were involved in trying to assist him. Gauteng, Western Cape have been able to deal with that much more effectively than it used to happen before. We are quite confident that provinces will be able to deal with this quite very well. We're not worried as we used to be worried before. And the turnaround time is even much quicker. The minister would recall that Gauteng used to have the largest number for obvious reasons, commercial capital of the country, the education system of Gauteng perceived to be among the best in the country. So in essence, Chair, I'm saying we're likely not to experience any problems. There are no reasons to worry there at all. And then, and I think learner transport remains a challenge. 5 out of 9 departments are actually not the Department of Education responsible for learner transport. Only 4 are departments of education, which we're working very well. We've got a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Transport, but the reality is, if there are chronic needs, education would respond differently from the way transport would respond. And we have made this explanation before to the portfolio committee. In terms of vaccination, number of teachers, support staff, learners, it might be difficult to give you those figures. When I checked with Dr. Whittle, we stood at 80%, and we could not delineate the figures between teaching staff and non-teaching staff because all of them were vaccinated together. And I think Dr. Patricia Watson is in the meeting. If she's able to assist with that question, I will implore her to do that. The feeding scheme and the poverty ranking of schools, we have reviewed, by the way, the poverty ranking of schools, but we don't have the funding to fully cover that, because as we pay in schools. If we had the money, we could proceed by tomorrow to do that. And I fully agree with Honorable Noda that it does happen that some quintile 4 and 5 would even absorb learners from your lower quintiles, and they have to carry the burden. But what we always advise is that provinces are at liberty to even include, some provinces have done so, to include even your quintile 4 and 5 schools to benefit from feeding from the national feeding scheme for learners. And then, the issue of making vaccination mandatory, I thought the president has just announced that he's going to establish a task team. It will help us a lot. I was part of the delegation of the minister to France, where vaccination is mandatory. They are at 90% vaccination. We are not. We are far below. But I think we need to wait for the task team that the president is going to establish. And perhaps follow the queue of, before we make pronouncements, I've been following them through the way of explaining it. It's actually encouraging more and more learners to vaccinate, which is what the minister has been doing. Every platform that the minister has been addressing is to really encourage people to vaccinate, not only in basic education, but broadly in the nation, because it's in our interest to do so. Chair, I did not intend to really cover everything, but in terms of curriculum coverage, you might want to call us back even next year. We've done studies. The team has done excellent work over and above what Dr. Nix Paul has done. Our team has also gone out to schools to do a research on the real impact of COVID-19 and curriculum coverage. What we've tried to do, Honorable Nodada, is that in trimming the curriculum, we said we cannot compromise on the fundamentals. But what we've also done is to identify specific grades where we say the entire curriculum must be taught. For instance, your grade 10, in some cases, your grade 11, in others, where provinces would vary from one province to the other, they would even insist on grade 7 and grade 12. We are meeting before the end of the year as part of preparing for next year to look at, you know, some of the things that we think are really the non-negotiables that must be in place to get us fully ready for the reopening of schools. And I must also say that even before schools are reopened, over and above getting information from provinces to give us their state of readiness, which is what we've shared with you, we also rely on the NECT plus Media 24, which are very independent from the department. They go out and give us a sense of our state of readiness. But remember that before, we did not have the number of teachers that we have who are vaccinated. We now have a risk-adjusted differentiated strategy, which has been applauded at various levels of the system, including the biggest civil society forum, to say we should follow that strategy, because that strategy is the answer to keeping schools open all the time, and that there's no need to close school. Now we also have a good number of learners who are also vaccinated, and that should put us in good stead in terms of arguing a very strong case instead in terms of state of readiness and bringing learners back. The last point that I want to make, Minister, is that one of the hallmarks of the innovation brought about in the department during the tenure of Minister Motshekga is that we've got a digitized business process in the department. You can sign documents from anywhere. And I like stretching it further on a lighter note to say you can virtually even sign some. You can sign them from the sky. And that we introduced before COVID-19, when deep offices were fully running, so I use that, the deputy minister, I only go to the office once or twice a week. The rest of the days I'm out in the three provinces, but I still sign everything that I need to consider. That's one of those innovations that we have brought into the system. And maybe the other one is coding and robotics. It's one of those innovations that were introduced in the curriculum during the tenure of Minister Motshekga. So I was just responding to the question of, and this is driven by young people in the department. If you look at our IT specialists, our young people who were brought initially as interns, and some of them are fully employed in the department. So we welcome the advice, and I also welcome the many advices that have been given by honorable members. And I want to commit to respond to other specific questions that we did not directly respond to. But just a word of caution, Minister likes warning us that we must be careful not to respond to a temporary pandemic or temporary crisis with permanent solutions. Whilst we are providing mobile classrooms, we should not put all our eggs in mobile classrooms. The brick and mortar, which is much more permanent, must proceed. And the same applies even to other areas of investment in the system. Chair, I'm going to humbly request that you allow Mrs. Geya, Dr. Watson, and the other colleagues who might be able to assist in terms of specific questions. The connectivity has been very merciful to me. Thank you very much, Chair.
Okay.
Yes.
Honourable Chairperson, yes. I think that both DG and Minister have covered most of the questions. I've been ticking them off as they have dealt with the questions. So there are very few left that I think we need to respond to still. I just wanted to say that the issue around the Mpopo's information, when the presentation was circulated, we did not have that information, but we since did get the information, and we did update the presentation. So the information when we flighted the provinces today, we had that slide, but I will just ask Mr. Mahada to recirculate the updated information that was outstanding previously, which we have since updated. The same applies to the LTSM. We also did ask a colleague to update the information, which was done. So when we spoke to the presentation today, it's not the same circulated information as what we had spoken to, that we had circulated to the members. And so therefore we will recirculate this updated presentation so that you could just get the holistic picture of all the provinces in terms of progress. Then I think there's a question as well that was asked around, where is this question now? Mm-hmm. There's a question around how we deal with the maritime schools and how we can increase our monitoring in relation to that. So there's a specific way in which we introduce these focus schools. It's not something that is just that we just you know, introduce, because you need to have the conditions, you need to have we need to have the funding, we also need to have the complement of teachers and learners to take up these subjects. So we take the point that has been raised by the Honourable Member around what we can do to increase the monitoring. We have a planned program that we are busy with, and where we can, we will then factor in the issues that you know, we can improve on to extend the subject, but also to improve on the way in which we then gain information and monitoring around that. Then there's the issue around online schooling. I think DG has covered that quite extensively in his response. But just to also indicate that, you know, where there are challenges of network, that's beyond our control, because the Department of Education is not responsible for ensuring that we put the network there. That is a bigger problem in the country, and from what we engage with in the Department of Communications and Digital Technology, that is not even always something that they themselves easily can solve the problem of, because of what the mammoth task is in the country. So Minister always says what we do best is that we teach in the classroom. And we also, the hard copies that we provide and the other innovative ways that we then provide the information to the learners through the TV channel and through the radio, where it's really bad for the online when we are in a lockdown situation. And also the hard copies, when the learners come on the rotational learning, we provide them with sufficient material for those days which they are not in school to go through the materials, and we download information for them. And, you know, we give them the hard copy material so that they do have that information. They are not lost. It's not lost that they are left behind from those who have access to connectivity and the network is working fine and the devices are also fine. So there's a plan B and a plan C that we have around these approaches that we use for the online schooling and online learning. And then there was another question which... spoke to the PGCE. I think the colleagues from the branch T may, there's a colleague here from branch T who may add on to that. But the PGCE is it is a program that has been gradually, it is intended to be phased out or discontinued, because the priorities and the needs of what we wanted to achieve in terms of the policy that we have on Mr. Tech, which is the qualifications framework that we use, changed and guided us towards rather having set programs of a degree program in the universities that is followed. And we built on that initially. And so for that reason, the PGCE became in a way redundant, because a new uptake of people who are doing the courses, the new graduates that come out of the university are trained on the more valid qualifications framework that is needed now for our subjects within the schooling system. Those who are still busy with the PGCE were allowed to continue to complete it, and they are still absorbed into the system. They are not considered to be redundant. You know, we do place them. But placement is about having a match of that what you are doing and that what is required in the system. So we can't just place a teacher if there isn't a vacancy that is suited towards that teacher. And so those are sometimes the reason why there's a delay in placement. At the end of the day, we have had a very good success story from our unemployed database of teachers who are recent graduates. They all get taken up within the first quarter. By the second quarter, you start to look for people because you don't have any more teachers on that database that are sitting there. So the success rate of placement from there, which is the opportunity we provide for teachers to be able, if they are not placed, to be able to be considered for placement, is always utilized. And also with the current constraints that we have been faced with, the number of vacancies that have been created, low numbers of teachers either going on retirement or on or through death and resignation have assisted us as well to place the teachers. I think those are the only questions that I could respond to. I think Dr. Watson can maybe respond to the issues which DG asked her to respond to, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and for the opportunity to support DG. The approach of the department to the vaccination of the education sector was broadly inclusive. So it looked at schools as ecosystems and invited as management teachers as well as service staff and general workers to come for the vaccine. And the success of the vaccination program was, I think, largely a result of this inclusive approach. So when everybody went from a school to get their vaccination, the Department of Health would have used people's ID numbers. And therefore, we are unable to disaggregate according to which members of the school population were more vaccinated than another category. But one thing that we are sure is that there was very broad-based uptake of the vaccines, and we're very pleased with the outcome of that campaign. Thank you.
I take it that all the questions have been responded to. Oh, I see Dr. Polia's hand.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chairperson. Good afternoon to our Minister. And good afternoon, Honorable Members. I just want to add on some of the curriculum questions that were possibly, you know, not fully covered. I think firstly, our DG covered the issue of curriculum coverage, but just to add that what we've agreed that we will utilize the next 3 years to ensure that we to some degree are able to address these losses. And we're hoping that in 3 years' time, we would be able to bring the system in terms of curriculum coverage to a point where we can then take the system to the next level. So in terms of the rotational model that has to be implemented in some schools and in some schools where they will be able to follow the full program, I think all of that has to be accommodated. And given the fact, like DG has mentioned, that we've trimmed the curriculum so that we focus on the core and fundamental, that will then help us over the next 3 years to make sure that the core skills are addressed and developed before we move to the next phase in terms of the curriculum program. With regard to the release of results, the ministerial announcement by our minister will be made on the 20th of January, that's the evening, and results will be released at schools on the 21st of January. With regard to the 0% schools, which was raised by Honorable Member, I think I just wanted to contextualize that, Chairperson, is that of those schools, only 8 of those schools were secondary, fully fledged secondary schools. The others were either part-time centers, independent schools, or special schools. And of those schools that scored 0%, our analysis shows that the numbers were extremely low. In most cases, the numbers varied between 5 and 8 learners. There were only 3 schools, in fact, 2 schools with 15 learners each, and 1 school with 22 learners. So these are, in fact, our smaller schools, which are non-viable schools, which need to be attended to in the future. But to answer the Honorable Member's question is that these schools were immediately visited, and they've been monitored continuously to identify what caused this 0% performance. And we will then make sure at the end of this year that those schools do not once again perform at this particular low level. And as much as we are monitoring these schools, we also focus all schools that perform below 50% and below 60% to make sure that they're able to push up their performance to the next level. And then the last question, which I think was not addressed, Honorable Chairperson, is the issue of the mother tongue bilingual instruction or education that is being piloted in the Eastern Cape at the moment. We are working closely with the province and monitoring to make sure that this is a pilot, and nationally we can then learn from the lessons of this pilot. But also we are making sure that learners that participate in this pilot are not disadvantaged in any way. For example, they administered the trial exam, the preparatory exam, using bilingual question papers in four subjects. And we evaluated those question papers to make sure that they are accurately translated. We monitored the writing. We'll also look at the analysis of the results. So we are working closely with them. We think this is a very critical intervention in terms of trying to address the language issue to some extent, not fully. And therefore, we're saying that this is still a pilot. It's being monitored and supported. And we're hoping to draw lessons that could be applied nationally from this particular pilot. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Dr. Polia. Any other hand from the department, or are we done?
Chairperson, I think we have answered all the questions in terms of what I've been monitoring on the list that I have. Yeah, thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much. I think then we are done with the answering of question. It's 1 o'clock, and 2 o'clock there is there's plenary. I think let me thank everybody in the meeting, the minister, the department, for this meeting. It was fruitful indeed, with a lot of information. But safe to say that we are ready for 2022. The department, I think, has eased us, has made us to be at ease, to see that they are ready for 2022. The minor challenges that are there, they will remain being there. I think we must just accept and wish that they are able to work on those. They can work on them. So without really wasting time, I think let me allow the department to leave us in the meeting so that we can quickly adopt the minutes of the previous meeting.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, honorable members. Thank you, honorable minister. Thank you, colleagues. Maybe I should walk you out. I can see that the DG is dragging his feet. DG.